Okay, we'd like to get started. I'd like to welcome you tonight to the Southern Region RAC. My name is Dave Black. I'm the chairman of the RAC committee. I'm from St. George, raised in Panguitch, and represent at large. We'd like to introduce the rest of the RAC tonight. Let's start down here on my far left with Claire.
Yeah, I'm Claire Woodbury from Hurricane. I represent the public at large.
I'm Cordell Pearson from Circleville, and I represent the public at large.
Lane Torgerson from Richfield, Sportsman's representative.
Sam Carpenter from Kanab. I represent Sportsman.
Rusty Aiken from Cedar City Agriculture.
I'm Kevin Bunnell. I'm the regional supervisor for the Southern Region and act as the executive secretary for this for the RAC.
Sean Kelly, Forest Service representative.
Brian Johnson, non-consumptives.
Dale Bagley from Marysville. I represent an elected official.
Thank you. Before we get started, I'd like to go through the meeting order just real quick. I'm sure you guys have been to a RAC meeting before, but if you haven't, as we go through each of these action items, we will first hear a presentation from the DWR, and then following the presentation, we'll provide an opportunity for the RAC committee to ask any questions, and then we'll open up questions to the public. Now, you'll have two opportunities to come to the mic, and the first opportunity is just for questions if you need a clarification or you have a specific question. If you have a comment, an opinion, a proposal, that will come later when we get to the comment section. And in order to come to the mic with the comment, you need to fill out a comment card, give it to a DWR representative, and they'll bring it up here. And then we'll go through the cards and call you up at that time. Okay, good. Yeah, we'll get the cards out. And so you don't need a card for a question, but we would like you to, at that time, keep your comments as a question. And then when we get to the comment section, then you'll have an opportunity to come forward. I assume that we have representatives here from the Utah Houndsman Association, is that correct? We received a letter. Is there somebody that's going to read this letter to us today? Or I'm just wondering how to get that into the minutes. Is somebody prepared to do that? Okay, great. And so I'll have a copy of that for Gianni if she needs that as well. The first action item is we need to have a motion to accept the agenda and the minutes for this evening. Okay, Sam?
I noticed in reading through the minutes that some of the people that didn't attend, RAC members, one was excused, the others weren't. I wondered what constitutes excused. I know I notified Kevin and you by email that I wouldn't be there.
Was you excused?
No, I was not excused. I was wondering, I had one of the board members call me, and how many meetings have you missed? And I said, no, I've missed a couple in 8 years, but I just wondered what constitutes getting excused for those.
Probably me remembering who contacted me and excusing them. So.
I'll make a motion that we accept the minutes.
Okay, we have a motion from Sam and a second from Cordell. All in favor? Okay, that passes unanimous. The next item on the agenda is a wildlife board update. At the last wildlife board, there's several action items. The first one was the turkey management plan, and that the motion to accept that plan as presented was approved. The next item was the turkey transplant proposed list, and there was a motion also to approve that as presented, and that was approved. However, there was also some comment in our RAC meeting here. We had proposed a number of additional sites, and they recognized those sites for transplant. They're going to, if I understand it correctly, they have to send it back through a process, and then those will come forth to us again, and those may come tonight.
Actually, you'll see them tonight.
And so we'll get a chance to vote on those to get those on the list. So they did recognize each of those areas that we had recommended and had discussion on those. So we'll hear more this evening.
Just to clarify that, when there's a process that we call RDCC, it's a kind of a clearinghouse that gives all of the local governments and federal agencies and other organizations, government organizations, an opportunity to comment on things that we're proposing as the Division of Wildlife. And so since those sites hadn't been through that RDCC process, that's what we had to redo. And so those have gone back out to the counties that were involved, and we didn't get any negative comments. So that should sail through smoothly tonight. But that was the only reason the board didn't do it at the time, is we had to go back through that process and allow local governments an opportunity to comment.
The next item was the upland game, turkey, and crane 3-year recommendations. There was a motion to accept that plan as presented, which passed. And then we got, there's the waterfowl recommendations. The motion there was also to accept the recommendations as presented, which passed. And then we got to the, which one had the crows?
That was that one.
No, okay, that one also included the crows, and there was quite a bit of discussion on that. And the vote on that one was 3-2, I believe, but it did pass. And then the next motion was regarding the Utah Trail Hunter Program. That passed unanimous. And
Did they talk about maybe us delaying that season like we talked about, or did that just go?
They did talk about that, Brian, but that ended up being such a big issue and so many comments and other things that came up. I think that season date thing kind of got lost in the shuffle just because there was so much going on. And just as an update, there was an additional board meeting today to deal with the crow issue because there was a protest at the next level up, and it again passed 3-2. The board voted on it a second time today. I don't know if Bill, if you want to add anything to that, but there was a large crowd today up in Salt Lake, and that's part of the reason that the board members aren't here, is they've already been to Salt Lake and back. And then Jake called me and asked me to excuse the board members. He had that going on, and he also had a grandson being delivered tonight, and he wanted to get home to be part of that. So he certainly has good excuse for not being here. So. Yeah. Okay.
I would assume there'll be opportunities in the future to kind of work on some details, but just to get that through was quite a process, and so they were lucky to do that. I think that's it as far as the main items that we were concerned with from the Southern RAC. And then we'll turn the time over to Kevin for an update.
As far as the regional update, I did want to excuse the two board members. They did contact me and let me know that they wouldn't be here and why, and with good reason. Just from the region, a couple things from our law enforcement section. It's especially appropriate here in Beaver to let you know that Brent Farnsworth has retired about 2 weeks ago, Scott. After 37 years, I believe, is that correct? 35 years working in our law enforcement section, so he will certainly be missed. We are anticipating that there's three officers that are kind of in our training program right now. We're hoping that one of them at the end of their training process will be assigned to the Beaver District, but that's not completely decided yet. So we'll just wait and see how that happens through the process. From our aquatic section, just to let you know that we have requested an emergency rule change for Paiute Reservoir. Paiute Reservoir is very low. We're anticipating drawing Paiute down as low as we can possibly get it this year and then doing a rotenone treatment to remove a bunch of unwanted species out of there and then restocking it. And so that we waste as few fish as possible, we're requesting an emergency change to increase the number of fish that can be kept at Paiute Reservoir between now and when the treatment takes place. That isn't completely through the process that has to take place for that to happen, but I don't anticipate any problems there. So watch for that. Probably here within the next week or 10 days, there'll be some information about a regulation change at Paiute Reservoir. Another thing that doesn't get talked about a lot at these meetings but was a huge undertaking in our sensitive species program, especially particularly the Virgin River fish recovery program. They completed a treatment that's taken years in the making down through the Virgin River Gorge and included Arizona Game and Fish and was very successful and should help that program be even more successful than it has been because they needed to remove some non-native fish that were having big impacts on what they're trying to accomplish. From our wildlife section, the biologists right now are in the middle of their antelope and elk classifications. We are dealing with a few bear issues in the region, but it hasn't been a real busy year for bears yet, and we hope, you know, that the rains will help that keep it from becoming a real bad year. We are planning another goat transplant this year from off the Tushers. That's currently scheduled for September 2nd and 3rd. We're working to get an open house scheduled to discuss some boundary issues relative to the Oak Creek unit, just to kind of figure out what's the appropriate way to manage that unit. So if you have an interest there, look for some information regarding that. And we're also working to get a tour set up for mountain goats on Mount Dutton. You may remember that the board asked us to put a committee together relative to help, you know, make sure that we're coordinating issues relative to goats on Mount Dutton, and this will kind of be the kickoff of that process. From our habitat section, 2 or 3 months ago, as you remember, everybody was very concerned about the water conditions and drought conditions that were developing. So the habitat section set up a kind of a drought assessment plan that they've been monitoring, particularly the West Desert, every 2 weeks. I'm glad to report that it's in much better condition now than it was earlier in the year. The recent rains have helped. In some places, there's been too many rains or too much rain. For instance, one of the roads on our Indian Peaks Wildlife Management Area is currently washed out. But we have a plan in place to get that repaired prior to the archery hunt starting here in about 3 weeks. So, you know, and with that, at this time, we're not anticipating any emergency antlerless recommendations. The board, through the original process, you'll remember there was already an increase in the number of antlerless tags out on that West Desert unit, and we think that's probably adequate to address current conditions out there. A couple of things coming up in our outreach section. If you're interested, we have an annual, a fairly large event with as a where we bring people up to look at the goats here on the Tushers. Lynn, maybe I'll let you fill in the details on that, if you would. Sorry, I should have warned you.
Yeah, typically we do that the first weekend of August, so that's going to be this Saturday. We'll be meeting at the parking lot at the Shell Station on the South Beaver exit. About 7:30, 8 o'clock or so, we'll leave and caravan on up to the top of the Tushers up through Big John Flat and up on top of the mountain right there. We've had anywhere from 35 to 75 cars that follow me up. So there's a lot of people that will come and watch that. Then we'll also be there Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and next Saturday for the Paiute ATV Festival. We'll be up there watching goats also for folks that drive by in that.
Okay. Thank you, Lynn. We also have a youth fishing clinic in Cedar City, August 9th. It's a great opportunity if you're from the Cedar area and have, you know, kids in your neighborhood that you're aware of that have an interest but have never had the opportunity to fish and to learn about fishing. That'd be a great place to get kids started. And similarly, there'll be a waterfowl hunting clinic held in Fillmore August 13th. Again, another opportunity to get, doesn't have to be kids, but people that have had an interest or want to get, break the ice with that, with hunting waterfowl, but have never kind of known what the first step is. We'll be holding a clinic in cooperation with some of the sportsmen's groups to kind of introduce people to waterfowl hunting on August 13th. So, if there isn't any questions, that's all I had, Dave.
How many goats are you looking to transplant off Tushers?
20. We'll be moving 20 goats from the Tushers again over to the LaSalle Mountains.
Okay, let's move to our first action item then. It'll be by Jason Robinson, and it's the turkey depredation rule, new rule R657-69.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jason Robinson, the Upland Game Coordinator out of the Salt Lake office, here to talk about turkeys again tonight. We're going to talk about the turkey depredation rule that we're bringing forward. We can go ahead, go to the next slide there. Just a little bit of background on turkeys before we dive into the rule. So just a little bit of background on turkeys to get us going here tonight. Turkeys were extirpated or locally extinct in many areas in the U.S. Turn of the century. Turkey numbers were at their lowest in the 1930s. And evidence shows wild turkeys are native to Utah. There's pictographs, petroglyphs, turkey bone, archaeological evidence. Some photos there just kind of showing some of the sites in southern Utah, especially showing some pictographs and stuff of turkeys. So reintroductions of turkeys started in Utah as early as the 1920s, but more aggressive and successful transplants began in 1989 and are continuing still. Turkey populations are now doing very well. You heard the last RAC meeting talking about the plan and the transplant list. So the big take home for this is turkeys are a real wildlife success story. We're able to basically bring them back from almost extinction, and they're doing quite well in the U.S. and Utah specifically. But with that, we've had some areas that we have some human-turkey conflicts, as we've talked about last RAC meeting. So the Wild Turkey Management Plan was revised, was just passed at this last board meeting, as you heard. Goal B under that management plan is to minimize human-wild turkey conflicts, specifically decrease the number of chronic material damage complaints by 25%. A little bit more background. A year and a half ago, House Bill 342, Wild Turkey Management, was passed at the state legislature. It basically created Wildlife Code 2317.5.1, which basically requires DWR to investigate and mitigate material damage to private property by wild turkeys. The division will respond within 72 hours. We have a variety of options: hazing, transplants, additional hunts. And what that wildlife code also does is gives rulemaking authority to the board. And so the division's proposing this rule. So to kind of sum up, the law is in place. That code set the law in place. And what we're trying to do with this rule is further define how the division will respond and implement this law, which is the rule we're bringing forward tonight. So rule 657-69, turkey depredation. If a turkey causes material damage to private property, the property owner reports it to DWR. Material damage is defined as physical impacts to private property caused by turkeys that are visible, persistent, and detrimental to the landowner and lessee of the private property. The DWR will respond within 72 hours to those complaints. DWR may remove those turkeys that are causing the issue for the landowner, or they can implement a damage mitigation and prevention plan with the landowner approval and signature on that plan. So within that plan, the division can provide educational materials, haze the turkeys off of the property, exclude the turkeys, so using fences or tarps or other mechanisms, depending on what the issue is. The division may capture and relocate the turkeys, allow harvest through limited entry or general season permits, walk-in access or CWMU programs, issue a depredation hunt, issue control permits to the landowner, or control permit vouchers to the landowner. And I'll talk about each of those in a little more detail. So capture and relocate is probably our primary tool. As you heard last RAC meeting, we have a lot of opportunity to grow turkeys here in the state of Utah. We have a lot of approved sites that we can move turkeys to. So if there's turkeys causing problems, we can capture them and move them to an area where they're less likely to cause problems. We have a long success of doing this, capturing the birds and them doing well when we put them in the right habitat. Again, 231 sites were approved statewide to move turkeys. And again, we're still trying to grow the turkey population. However, this doesn't work in all situations, and so we've got to have other tools available. So one of those tools is a depredation hunt. So this is a focused response to verified reports of material damage. These hunts will be in small areas with short notice and limited number of permits. Basically, a hunter would apply online in the hunter depredation pool. They'd be selected randomly. They must have a valid hunting and or combination license. They must purchase a turkey permit to take part in this. And the UDWR regional supervisor, so for your region, Kevin, would basically approve the boundary, season dates, bag limits, number of turkeys to be harvested, et cetera. The next option available would be control permits for turkeys. So this would be part of that damage and mitigation plan. Would be a maximum of 2 control permits per calendar year. The permits would be for the landowner or lessee or their immediate family. And these control permits would be free to the landowner to take care of the problem. Is basically would be valid for one either sex turkey on the private property. The next option would be control permit vouchers. So again, this would be part of that damage mitigation and prevention plan. DWR may issue vouchers for up to 10% of the documented turkeys on the property with a maximum of 15 per calendar year for the landowner to give away. So again, these would be for the landowner or lessee or a designated third-party recipient. So the landowner could then provide that voucher to essentially anyone that they felt that they wanted to have that permit. A landowner may not gain financial compensation for the voucher's use. A voucher allows the holder to purchase a control permit, so then that would be a valid hunting license. And then they would also have to have a combination or a valid hunting license to go along with that turkey permit. Each control permit, again, is valid for one either sex turkey on the private property. That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Sean?
Hey, Jason, this might be getting a little ahead, but I know it's on the rule that there's an allowance for a 2-mile buffer for control permits. Under what conditions would you apply that?
It would be up to the discretion, basically between the division and the landowner. If you had a whole bunch of turkeys concentrated in a very small private property, so it's causing some damage on that particular property owner, but they're moving off, that makes it hard to maybe harvest some of those birds, but they're coming back, we might be able to put a buffer there to allow those birds to be moved even further or to have some of those birds harvested. So it would be both the landowner and the division as part of that mitigation plan.
If that buffer were to overlap, we'll say, public land during a big game hunt, would there be a hunter orange requirement associated with hunting those birds? Or?
It'd be a case-by-case basis. So the region would have to determine if that needed to be in place or if they could stop it at public land or whatever. And one of the things with a fall hunt is it's not like a spring hunt. So these hunts would occur mostly in fall and winter. So the importance of camouflage isn't quite as critical as it is in a spring hunt.
Just to understand it better, you think this would be fairly rare that they'd incorporate a 2-mile buffer on a control permit?
Correct. The main objective of this is to help the landowner deal with damage to his property. And so we want to focus those permits and that effort on the private landowner's property.
Any additional questions? Are we going to see any fall hunts this year?
Yes. In the current guidebook that's out available now, there are fall hunts that will take place beginning in November of this year. So if the hunter's interested, they can get a copy of that guidebook and see when the season dates are and everything. It's out.
Okay. Rusty?
On the valid hunting license, combination license, does the mentoring program, would it pertain to this? Could a mentoring person be included in that?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess I haven't thought through that exactly, but as long as they met all the requirements of both this hunt and the mentoring program, they should be able to qualify.
Yeah, be a good opportunity, I think, for
young. And a landowner can you know, if they're related or if it's a voucher, they can just provide that to a youth to hunt on their property.
Do we have any questions from the public? Okay. Do we have any comments from the RAC? We don't have any comment cards from the public, so I think we're ready to entertain a motion.
I'll make a motion. We approve Rule 657-69 as presented.
Okay. Looks like we have a motion and a second from Lane. Is there any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? It passes unanimous. Okay, we'll move to the next item, which is item number 6, the proposed fee schedule, FY 2016, and Kevin Bunnell will be presenting.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'm kind of pinch hitting for Kenny Johnson, our admin services chief, on this tonight. So those of you that have been on the RAC for a while, I recognize that we come with some fees every year about this time because there's a long process that's involved in getting a fee instituted. This is the beginning of that process. So first it has to go through the through the RACs and then to the Wildlife Board, and usually what the things we deal with are done at that point, but that's just still the beginning of the process when it comes to fees. So after the Wildlife Board approves a proposed fee, it then goes to the governor's office, who has to approve it and recommend it to the legislature. It then goes through the Natural Resources Subcommittee in the legislature. If they approve it, it's then voted on the annual appropriations bill by the entire legislature. So fees in particular, it's a long road. And so we're pretty strategic when we bring any new fees or fee increases out through this process. So just to give you a little background on, you know, the division is pretty unique when it comes to state agencies. We're one of the few state agencies that's essentially self-funded. You can see this pie graph up here. About 50% of our funding is what we term as restricted funds, which is essentially licensed dollars. Another about 12% was dedicated credits. That's other things like if people attend, go to Hardware Ranch or places where we charge a fee, or contributions from sportsmen's groups come through that. About 30% of our funding is federal funds through Pittman Robertson and Dingell Johnson and other federal programs that are dedicated funds for wildlife management. And then you can see only about 9% of our entire budget comes from what's termed as general fund or essentially tax dollars from the public. So we're fairly unique in that way. So because of that, you know, because we're largely funded by hunters and anglers, we try to balance fees with increasing costs and what we need to do to manage wildlife. And for 2015, there's a couple of opportunities that we've identified to help with that. The first one is a fee change relative to bobcats, also one for muskrats, and then two new fees. One would be a 2-cow elk permit, and then also we'd like to put a fee in place for potential ewe hunts in the future for both species of bighorn sheep. And again, this is just the very beginning of this process. If we were ever to implement any of this stuff, it would come all the way back through this process, you know, before there was ever, you know, something like a ewe hunt put on a particular unit. This is just to put the mechanism in place. If we ever need that as a tool for management, we would be able to at least make the proposal. We're not doing this to try to raise revenue. Our analysis of the total impact of the fees that I'll show you tonight would be, you know, about $60,000, which is a very small percentage. It's not something that's going to that we're doing really to try to raise revenue in the division, but it will help with some of the particular programs that I'm going to talk about tonight. So with bobcats, our costs continue to increase. Specifically, we've introduced in the new management plan that came in. Well, it's 4 or 5 years old now. Put into place some rabbit trance, some information to gather on what the prey base is for bobcats and helps us to manage them that way. We also age the teeth for bobcats as part of the management plan, and we're sealing all the jaws and pelts, which is administrative time. And the increased revenue that will come from this fee will help with those efforts. And it is worth pointing out that last year the average pelt price for a single bobcat was $407 per individual. So the fee increase that we're proposing, currently it's $5 per bobcat tag. We're recommending that go up to $15 per individual tag for residents, and from $5 up to $45 for non-residents. Muskrat fees. So this doesn't apply to recreational trapping at all. The fee that we're talking about tonight is specific to we have a need for bobcats to be trapped off of a lot of our waterfowl management areas to protect our dikes and to help protect some of the resources that we have there. And so we have a need to make sure that we get the right person in there doing that knows what they're doing and works well with our folks on those waterfowl management areas. And although
We've been fairly successful in doing that. We don't have any assurances in the current structure that we can, you know, we don't have any way to pick who might be the best person to accomplish those management goals for us. So what we're proposing is that we're just going to get rid of this fee altogether and put it into a bid process where people will bid for the opportunity to, and through the bid process, what that does for us is we can put certain requirements that anybody that bids has to be able to meet before they qualify to be considered to get the contract to work on one of our waterfowl management areas. So again, currently it's kind of depends on the number of muskrats we anticipate being trapped or the person anticipates trapping on a waterfowl management area. So it has ranged anywhere from $30 up to $155. Again, it'll go to an open bid process if this structure that we're proposing tonight is ultimately passed. Moving on to two cow elk permits. This is strictly just to give us another tool to manage cow elk and elk populations, particularly in the northern part of Utah where we have a lot of private land and access is a real issue. You're probably familiar, we have a couple places where we issue two doe permits to deal with similar issues in places where we have a lot of private land, but I don't think it's out of the question that we would put something like this in place in the southern region on a place like Mount Dutton where we have a hard time getting enough harvest on cow elk. And so it's just another tool that we could for the biologists and the managers to consider and use, you know, where it makes sense to do so, where we need it to help manage our elk populations. Again, it would be, we're estimating, so $80 for a two cow permit. That's actually, so if you bought just two cow permits right now, it'd be $100. So it's a little bit less expensive than two individual cow permits. But again, it's really being proposed as a management tool to help us deal with some areas where we have a hard time getting hunter access. Bighorn sheep, hunting ewes. You know, right now when we have, you know, we have pretty strict rules in place or policies to keep bighorn sheep in the areas where it's appropriate for them to be because there are conflicts. If bighorn sheep wander off of the units and come in contact with domestic sheep, it has the potential to be devastating to our bighorn sheep populations. And so right now when we have things like that happen, we usually end up removing those animals to mitigate the risk of them coming back and affecting the rest of the herd. So there are situations where we'd like to use hunters to do that in the future, where if we have an opportunity to allow someone to harvest that animal rather than a biologist doing that, we'd certainly like to do that. And it's also, you know, there's probably going to come a time when we need to hunt bighorn sheep ewes just strictly to manage populations. Bighorn sheep is if populations get too robust, they start wandering off the units, and that's where we have problems. A lot of you are aware of the issues, the concerns we have with the Zion unit because of the park and our inability to manage sheep there. Just in the last year, we had to remove a young ram that had left, came out of Zion National Park, and we removed it there on Highway 20. So he had come probably, 40 miles out of the park and out of appropriate bighorn sheep habitat. So those are the kind of things that we deal with, and it would be nice to have another tool in the toolbox to allow hunters to help us with that. So the fee that we're proposing is $100 for residents and $300 for non-residents. You know, that estimated quantity of 10, I would say that's probably several years down the road before we'd even reach that level. But, you know, we need to put some sort of an estimate in there but for that. And just in answer, there's probably some questions, you know, with sheep being a once-in-a-lifetime species, a ewe hunt wouldn't be once in a lifetime. It'd be a 5-year waiting period, and if this event goes through and we end up in this sort of a program, 5-year waiting period, and we would institute a separate points system, particularly, you know, just for bighorn sheep ewes. So in summary, so we're nothing real earth-shattering here tonight, I don't think. Some minor adjustments. It gives us some new management tools. It will bring some a small amount of money in, especially into the fur bearer program with bobcat tags to help cover some of the costs that we incur there. And
It'll provide some new opportunities for the public. So with that, I'll I think Bill and I can tag team questions.
Okay. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Sam?
Why are elk and sheep going towards the fur bearer plant and not towards the species themselves?
Well, the fees always come out this time of year because it's part of the legislative process. We have a due date that we have to get stuff to the governor's office. So again, you know, Sam, this is just to put a fee in place so that if we ever instituted anything like this, we have it in place. If before you would ever see, you know, two cow elk permits implemented or ewe hunts, it would come back through this process, through the big game rack, and you'd have an opportunity to evaluate that on each individual case and on its merits. This is simply to have a structure in place if we ever needed to do that.
So in the end, it would probably be changed by the time these hunts actually materialized.
I'm not understanding what would be changed.
Well, I'm saying that the bighorn sheep, the ewes, that money would go towards bighorn sheep. The elk would go towards big game. When it was finally materialized, it wouldn't go towards the fur bearer. This is just
because of the legislative process that we have to go through. This is the time of year when we always bring fees out. It's always during the July rack.
Do we have any other questions from the rack? Rusty?
How long has the bobcat been $5?
Yeah, let me come handle bobcat question.
Actually, I can talk about this because I've been involved in bobcat management for a long time. But bobcat fees were originally $5 when the permits were started. I think it was probably about 1978. Well, yeah. Anyway, in 1975, we had the CITES Act, and bobcat trapping was closed for a few years, and it's probably 1980. But anyway, that time period, so it's been $5 ever since at least 1980. And where that money, you know, how the money is used for bobcats, right now it's $5 per permit. And I believe that what we do is we age every bobcat that is turned in, and I believe it's about $4 per tooth. Yeah, okay. So anyway, that's what it's used for aging the deer or the bobcat teeth, and then also we do a survey. The money would go towards that, and then also the time to check in bobcats to have them sealed.
Thank you. Do you have another question, Rusty? Nope. Anybody else? Okay, we'll turn time over to the audience for questions, and then in just a few minutes we'll go through the comment card. So if you have a question, feel free to come forward. If you do come forward to the mic tonight, please state your name. Okay, let's move right into the comments then. How many of you here are from the Utah Trappers Association, by the show of hands? We want to thank you for coming. We appreciate you being here for your input. And if you had to travel a long ways, we appreciate you being here tonight. The first card that we have is from Kent. You'll have to help us with your last name, Kent. Kent Fowden.
Mr. Chairman, RAC Board. I represent the Utah Trappers Association. We're not opposed, or we oppose such a large increase in the fees. We understand administrative fees. It's not really been an issue since 1980. Some of the proposals are good. I commend the fishing game on the muskrat. That's been needed. That the hands of the managers have been tied. So the non-resident part, we support that on the bobcats. Such a large increase all at once is kind of a shocker. Again, administrative fees and that, we understand that. It's just such a large increase when it's not been addressed since 1980. Utah's the only state that even has the temporary tags. again, we understand administrative costs, but we feel that since 1980, there's not really been any foundation for the increase. Thank you.
Okay. I also have a number of cards here that would like to get their comments out, but they indicated that they didn't want to come forward. You still have an opportunity to do that if you like, but let me go through these cards. I have one from Jason Davis. I agree with the
Utah Trappers Association.
UTA, Utah Trappers Association. And that, that the number of tags, but I think that they should stay at $5. I also think that the
check day
should be changed from 48 hours to 72 hours or 96 hours. Okay, so we'll leave that out here so we make sure we address the hours in our discussion. I think that the season should be longer. I also think that the price should increase, but not more than $10 per tag. This is Randy Robinson. Travis, regarding the fee schedule, I think tripling the cost of the bobcat tag is too extreme. I'm fine with the fee increase, but in gradual steps. Mike Hart, I support the tag increase, but do not want the fees to go up. Alan Hart, I like the proposal of the bobcat tag going up to 6. I don't like that the tags are going up in price. Norm Hart supports the Utah Trappers Association, and we have a comment from Randall Robinson. I feel that the Utah Trappers Association proposal should be enacted. Tag fees for the bobcat should not change too dramatically. Is there anybody else that has a comment card that we need to discuss? So it looks like in the comment cards, the majority of those are regarding the fee increase, and then there was also a comment card that was talking about the check days from 48 to 72 or 96.
That's relevant to the bobcat racks, not to the fee schedule.
Okay, so that'll be coming up in the next presentation.
Dave, did the letter comment on the fee schedule? What's the ETA word on the fee schedule? The email that we all got? You got folded out there.
This one?
Yeah.
From the Utah Houndsman?
Kent, do you guys have a fee that you're proposing in as an alternative to the $15 from the association?
No, sir. In answer to your question, it's kind of a shocker. It was just recognized on the website. It wasn't really advertised, so there hasn't been a lot of time given to it. I had a discussion with Mr. Bates, and like I say, we do recognize that there is some, over time, there has been some changes in management and things of that nature that increase the cost. We do recognize that. We feel like it should have been addressed over a period of time as things has changed, rather than a knee-jerk reaction, in our opinion, to what happened with the fiasco in October. That's the feeling of the trappers, is it's a knee-jerk reaction. Again, we understand administrative costs, the cost of living, everything, that part of it, we understand that. It's just tripling all at once is just kind of a shocker. Again, Utah's the only state that has the tags, and we wonder about the need even to have the tags. And then one last comment, the average price of a pelt is $407. in all honesty, it probably costs close to $600 to harvest one. So that's a misnomer. Thank you.
I guess one comment I might have is we're the first RAC, I think, that's meeting. If you add some suggestions for a fee increase that went to some other RACs or even before the board when the board meets, and that might be helpful as well. So, do we have any comments from the RAC?
I have a question. What do other surrounding states, if we're the only ones that do tags, what do the surrounding states do for bobcat harvest? How do they handle it?
I can't tell you state by state, but I know that what most of them do is just require you to have a fur bearer license, and you know, and I can't answer, you know, if there are, I don't know if Colorado charges anymore or not, but but most of them just require you to have a fur bearer license.
Sam?
Was there any discussion amongst DWR on why they would increase the tags as drastically as they have? What was the justification?
Well, the price, you know, this is something that, you know, Kent is right. This is something we should have looked at over time, but pretty much since bobcats are kind of, you know, there's not a lot of people that hunt hunt or trap bobcats, it's kind of just slid under the, you know, the radar, so to speak. And we, after what happened last October, in case you're not aware, we accidentally raised the price to $15 on the website. And so what Kent's talking about is that at 8 o'clock, you know, it turned on to, you know, what we had is first come, first serve, you know, buy three bobcat tags, and people weren't flinching at paying $15 a piece. So in some respects, he's right. We took that as an indication that since we didn't receive a lot of complaints, and it wasn't even brought to our attention for a while, that, you know, the market value is probably higher than where it had been set. And then we also looked at, you know, what it was costing us to run the bobcat program in particular. And, you know, I think that they've had some good comments, and one thing I'm going to go back and do is have, you know, the person, Leslie McFarland, who's involved in, who's our new mammals coordinator, and Heather Bernalis, who does our data analysis, have them look at what it costs to run the bobcat program. And so one thing you might think about is, you know, if a recommendation might be modified to accurately reflect what the program costs. I mean, we just threw this out as a kind of a straw dog to see, you know, what the public thought about it. And also, this won't take effect this next fall. This is something that, like Kevin described, has to go to the governor's office, to the legislature, then come back to the RACs. And if it's approved, the next time we would bring it to the RACs and the board would most likely be next November, because we're going to go to one hunting guidebook next year. And that means we may not even be implementing this until the following January, or maybe not even the next season. So.
That's not quite right, Bill. With a fee, once it's gone through the legislature, that's the fee, and it would be implemented as of July 1st, 2015.
But if we've already sold those bobcat tags,
anything sold after July 1st, 2015 would have
you're
the higher,
right.
the higher
so
fee.
So they would be the $15 in October. You're right. Thanks for that. So
did we refund the people that paid $15 for a $5 tag?
We did. I sit on the error committee, and we had 900 errors. And it was painful.
Could this be progressionary, maybe over a period of time, other than just hit them all at once?
Well, I think so. But I think what I would like to do is go back and look at what the actual cost of the program is, and maybe with the Utah Trappers Association, maybe talk about what legitimate costs are and see what it's costing us to do the activities we're doing. So, okay. But so I mean, that's just something for you to think about. Our recommendation is for $15, but that is an option, is to have us look closer.
Okay, so I understand if we do pass this recommendation for $15, when it comes back in November, it will be set. Is that true? So once we pass this at this rack, it goes to the board and is passed, it will be $15.
Not necessarily. What happens is that if you recommend the Wildlife Board pass this, the Wildlife Board still has the option of taking input from all the racks. They may change the price. And then when we take to the governor's office after the wildlife board passes it, they may change the price. And then when we take it to the legislature, there's still an opportunity for it to be changed. But typically, if we have a good recommendation, then it gets approved clear through the process. And I would say this one probably needs to be looked at a little closer.
So would you propose that we wait until we actually see what the costs are then to take this?
Okay, I have to be careful here because our division proposal is for $15. But if you want to make the recommendation that we adjust the fee to represent what the cost of program is, that is certainly something we could take into account.
How would you houndsmen or you trappers feel about that? Does that sound a little more fair than the big jump?
Okay.
Yeah. So they buy a license as well as the...
Right. The fur bearer license allows them to take beaver, you know. Yeah.
And what does the license cost?
Oh, what is it? $30?
Well, how much?
29.
29, okay.
And that gives them six bobcats?
No, they have to... They have... You buy the tag.
It's unlimited for, how many tags.
Right. Tag per bobcat.
Last year was three. This year
we're last year's three. We're going to make a proposal to make it six here later tonight, and that's up to you guys to decide.
Okay. Also, I was just going to remind you we don't have a motion yet, and so we can tailor that motion the way that we'd like. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to put words in your mouth either, but we might could say that it reflect the actual costs and not to exceed $15 or something like that.
We can tailor
it any way we want to set that motion up.
We're taking it out for public comment, and that's what we're here for.
I just have a comment over here. I understand that these guys went and bought their bobcat tags for $15 a piece, but if you take something that somebody loves and you put a $100 bill on there, they probably would have bought it and figured it out later because they didn't want to have that opportunity taken from them. And I'm sure that they just figured they'd get their money back after the fact.
Yeah.
And so for them to say, for an entity to say, well, nobody really squealed too loud. My heck, we just took something they love to do, and it's first come, first serve. So these guys just pulled out their wallet and got it done because they figured they'd make it right later, and they didn't want to come and wait for it to get fixed and then not get a bobcat tag. Am I right? Is that kind of what you were thinking? Yeah.
Yeah, and I agree with that. But I just want to clarify, though, that the reason for the increase is not that there are legitimate increases in the program.
I understand that. It just sounds kind of funny that it's the same amount.
Well.
I mean, I don't know. I'm just being a cynic.
You know, you can put that on my shoulders because the director's office asked, what should it be? And I said, well, let's go with $15 and see what the public thinks. So,
okay. Are we ready to formulate a motion?
I'll make the motion.
Okay, Cordell.
Okay. I would like to make a motion that we accept DWR's proposal, except for the fee on the bobcats, and we take a look at that and see what the actual cost is. And once we find out that actual cost, then that will be our recommendation. Okay?
And that it will not exceed $15.
Right, and it will not exceed $15.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion from Cordell and a second from Rusty. Is there any discussion on the motion? Claire?
I don't know that I would accept if it doesn't exceed $15. If it costs $20 to run the program, why would we want to lose money in any of our programs?
I think some of that should come from the fur bearer's actual $29 license fee. I mean, there should be a percentage of that that comes from the $29 fur bearer fee. And so, I don't know.
They've been living on $5.
Yeah, they've been living on $5 since 1980, so.
Can't be that.
Yeah, I was just going to say that same thing. I mean, it don't seem like that fee is that costly at this point in time, or evidently we haven't looked at it real close. So I do want to leave the motion as it is. It does not exceed $15 at this time.
Okay, we do have a motion and a second, and we can vote on that motion, or we could, if Claire wanted to amend the motion, we'd vote on the amendment first. Okay, let's vote on the motion. All those in favor? All those opposed? Motion carries. Okay, the next item on the agenda is the Cougar Management Plan revisions and the 2015 recommendations, and they'll be presented by Bill Bates.
Well, I'm glad to be here tonight. Leslie McFarland is our new mammals coordinator, but unfortunately she couldn't be here tonight. She has been serving as our wildlife disease coordinator, and she is in Albuquerque, New Mexico. She was asked to be the keynote speaker down there to address the West Nile virus outbreak we had with eared grebes and bald eagles on the Great Salt Lake this last year. So, you know, we apologize that she couldn't be here. But I look forward to Leslie being representing us with these two programs we're going to talk about tonight, and I think she'll do a great job. What I'd kind of like to preface what we're going to talk about tonight with some direction we received from the Wildlife Board last year. If you can, how many of you on the board or on the RAC were here last year? Would you just raise your hands? Were all of you here? Do you remember how complicated the cougar recommendations were with the area, you know, cougar management areas, cougar management units? And it was even a little bit hard for John Shivick, who is our coordinator at that time, to explain. And just to mention, John has taken a job with the Forest Service and no longer works for us. But we were directed by the board to come back and look at managing cougars on a unit-by-unit basis. And so tonight we're going to make a couple of recommendations. This will still be under the auspices of the 2009 Cougar Management Plan that was approved by the RACs and board, but we're going to implement some or recommend some changes that simplify it and allocate permits on a unit-by-unit basis. Specifically, to help through this get through this process, we met with the Utah Houndsmen Association, with the Utah United Wildlife Cooperative and Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife, and also with the Utah Big Game Hound Association, I believe, out of San Pete County, to help refine these recommendations. And what we decided to recommend this year was that we would still, following the plan, still use a three-year roll-up over the cougar management area to look at data, just to, you know, because cougars, you know, you're not harvesting a lot on a unit, maybe, but over the area, that gives us more data, makes it more statistically significant. So the data will still be analyzed that way, but permits and quotas will be allocated just on the units. So a specific unit, the quota will be set, and when it closes on that unit, it's closed. Not, you won't have to worry about how many females do I have left over in this area, and, you know, if this unit closes, is my unit going to close? It's just going to be unit by unit, and hopefully we'll simplify things. The other thing we would recommend is that rather than having permits and quotas issued for a three or allocated on a three-year basis, that we just do it on a yearly basis and come back to you annually. And as part of that also, it's not on this slide, but a recommendation I would include in there is that we call the Cougar Working Group back together and revise the plan and, you know, early and try to implement these with a broad consensus and bring a new plan back to you next year. And finally, we would also recommend that the female subquotas be eliminated, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in the next couple of slides. Like I said, we'd like to ask for the RACs and board's permission to reopen the plan with input from the Cougar Advisory Board to further simplify the plan. And one thing that these groups asked us to do was to look at considering all female cougars in the analysis. If you recall, the performance targets required us to look at the percent of adult females. So subadult females weren't being evaluated in our recommendation or, you know, or whether we met our performance targets or not. And there's been quite some concern with that. So what they would like us to do is go back to the standard of not exceeding 40% total females on a cougar management area. And just to refresh your memory on how these look, the big, bold black lines represent the cougar management areas. So you have the Cache, Oker Stansberry, Uintas, Wasatch, Manti, Bookcliffs, the Bighorn Sheep units, the San Juan, Monroe, and Pine Valley. Then you look within those, you see the lighter shaded or kind of gray lines. Each one of those represents a cougar harvest unit. So for instance, you may have Nine Mile Range Creek, the Book Cliffs, Diamond Mountain, South Slope, Yellowstone, Camas, and so forth. And what we're talking about is allocating permits on those smaller units rather than on the big units. The performance targets that we've talked about right now, and I've got the wrong presentation here. Somehow, you opened the wrong one.
You want me to close it?
Yeah, go ahead and do that and bring the other one up. Real quickly, the way that for a cougar management unit, and if you recall, there's a difference between cougar management units versus predator management units. If we have units where the deer population fails to meet certain guidelines, for instance, if it's below, I don't remember off the top of my head without looking at the slides, but 60%, well, right over here. Let's go back a slide. A couple. Let's see. Well, anyway. Predator management units, if we have problems with bighorn sheep recruitment or predation on bighorn sheep or with deer, if we have problems meeting our deer management objectives, then we put units into predator management plans. And so the criteria are different for those versus a cougar management area, which are supposed to follow the guidelines of the cougar management plan. So if it isn't a cougar management area, the primary target we've been talking about are required to follow is the proportion of adult females in the harvest needs to be between 17% and 20%. If it's above or below that percentage, then we're required to adjust it. What the request of especially the Utah Houndsman Association, in order to consider all females, we also ran this looking at 40% total females in the harvest, and so we've used that criteria to make our recommendations this year as well, just so you can see any differences. And the secondary target we have is looking at the number of cougars treed per day. It needs to average between 0.25 and 0.35. Predator management units, the regions are allowed to choose either a split or a harvest objective strategy where with the cougar management areas, they're primary limited entry or split units. Unit closes when all the permits or quota are filled or when the season ends. We have three units, the Bookcliffs, Rattlesnake, Parowitz, and Santa Fe, with bighorn sheep and low numbers of cougars that are basically open year-round with an unlimited harvest. This graph shows you our historic cougar harvest from 1990 when we implemented the limited entry cougar hunting management system till now. And as you can see that we had a peak about 1996 and we've leveled off. Percent females or the number of females has been stable for about the last 9-10 years. And the percent females, total females in the sport harvest right now is averaging about 33%. So we're below that 40% total females in the harvest statewide. For our recommendations for this year, we would recommend that our limited entry seasons go from November 12th through the May 31st. Splits go through the November 12th through February 20th. Then with the harvest objective on those split units, it starts March the 5th and goes through May 31st. And then on the straight harvest objective, those would go from November 12th through November 8th. Pursuit season, we recommend going from November 12th through May 31st. And I just want, stepping back to the percent females in the harvest, looking on a cougar management area basis, I just wanted to make you aware of where we are. Total females, not just the adult females. You can see on the cash over the last 3 years, we averaged 32%, Monroe 36%, Ochre, Sanctuary is 23%, Pine Valley 31%, San Juan 21%, which is a predator management unit, which is we would like to have higher harvest on that one. The Uintas has been 38%, and the Wasatch Manti has been 33%. If you look at an individual year, the only two that, well, you've got, we had 40% on the Monroe in 2011, which is right at that target of 40%. On the Uintas, we had 42% in 2012, and in the Manti, we had 40% this last year. Maybe this is too much detail. But anyway, another recommendation we have for this year, we'd like to split the Pine Valley unit into two different units. And the reason for that is that we would like to make the north unit a split unit and the south unit a harvest objective unit to protect bighorn sheep so we can institute some predator management scenarios down there to try to help the bighorn sheep down in that area. And I believe that, was it Highway 18 that is the boundary through there? So, another thing that doesn't really show up on in my presentation, but Mount and Dutton, we're also recommending an increase on the quota, isn't it? We're increasing that by two to protect on Mount and Dutton for
goats.
Yeah, what's that? 12 to 16 on the Dutton to help the goats that we just transplanted there. And also on Oak Creek, we're increasing that one by two, right, Riley? Yes. To protect bighorn sheep up in that area. So anyway, this year we're recommending a total of 253 limited entry and split permits, which is, you can see, it's been a reduction over the last 2 years. And, you know, if you're interested in individual units, they're in your packet. But if there's any you'd like to talk about, I think I've highlighted everything in the region that's changed. Anyway, one other one that's going to be a little bit controversial statewide, though, is the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek. Last year, I believe we had a quota of 40 on the entire cougar management area, and 35 of those were taking on the Book Cliffs and only 5 over on the 9 Mile Range Creek. And our recommendation initially was to make that about a 30-10 split this year on going to the unit-by-unit basis, but the houndsmen felt strongly that we hit that populational too hard, so we've adjusted that to having 20 on the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek and 20 on my 9 Mile Range Creek. And other than that, I think that about covers it, unless you have any questions. I know Leslie knows this a lot better than I do, but hopefully it made sense to you.
Thank you. Do you have questions from the rack?
Would there be possibility to split the Zion unit north and south? Dustin.
Uh-huh.
Do the Zion unit with a split unit to protect the sheep? What would you do?
It's already hard. Teresa said that's already
it's
harvested.
It's an open. Unlimited.
Yeah. It's already harvest objective. So we're getting good harvest there. We've typically usually always got good harvest there.
So there's a max of 20 total?
Which would never come close to reaching. Yeah.
But we probably didn't reach that last year.
Have any other questions from the RAC?
Yeah. I'm hoping you're a lion expert because I read through the plan, mm-hmm. and there's just so many things in there that I guess I just didn't really understand about mountain lions. And so I've gone in and done a lot of research on the internet, and you can find about anything you want out there is what I've learned. But I've never heard what kind of ratios you have on a male to female in a mountain lion population. What are the ratios on those?
Oh, that's a tough one. I think that the best place to get some information on that would be in Utah, would be two different places. We did a 10-year study on the boulders under the direction of Dr. Fred Lindsay out of Utah State, and then through Dr. Mike Wolf on the Monroe and Dave Stoner. We've done about a 15-year or maybe even longer than that now on the Monroe. And typically what happens is, the birth ratio, of course, is about 50-50. But what you have is you have resident toms that establish larger territories than the females. And so typically within the home range of one male, you'll have either two or three females. But on the other hand, you have juvenile males or, those that aren't able to establish a population because they either get killed or, they wander off. And so I would guess that it's tipped towards females, but...
Okay. Well, The information I was able to obtain, and there were several places that agreed to this, is about a 60-40 female-to-male
that's probably
relationship.
That's a much shorter answer than I gave. Thank you.
And the next question that I tried to find is how many kittens are in a litter on average for lions?
I believe it's like 2.3 or...
Okay, well, three to six is what the consensus is.
Three to six is what they can have, but if you're looking at averages, it's a different thing.
And how many of them survive to adult?
I'm sure we could dig that up.
I'm just burying you with stuff that probably is going to be irrelevant. They say 60%, so. Okay, and another thing I learned on there is that a cougar requires 8 to 10 pounds of meat per day to sustain.
Depending.
Do you agree with that?
Fred Lindsay had a graduate student that did a lot of work on that on the boulder. And what he found, it depends on the, whether it's an adult tom, an adult female, a sub-adult female. And on average, a cougar, kills a deer per week, according to that study. A female with kittens kills one every 4 days. Subadult female once every 10 days.
Okay. Well, this was not and one thing they did specify on most of the accounts that I read was that they may eat 30 pounds of meat one day and go for
four or five days
without this.
They
just an average
they gorge themselves
in captivity to sustain them.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll let that go. I've got.
A lot of interesting things, information.
Any questions down at this end, Brian? Cordell?
Yeah, and I don't think that you was here, but when we talked, and it's been probably 6 months ago, 8 months ago, that we asked. Do you remember this? That we asked for the person that was doing the study on the Monroe come to this meeting and explain to us, how many cougars he tagged, how many females, how many males, and that's been at least 6 or 8 months ago, and we've never seen anybody.
Okay. No, Cordell, I have to push back on that. We held a special open house just on that topic in Richfield, invited everybody to be there because we couldn't cover that topic and give it justice in 20 minutes at a RAC meeting. So we held a meeting for about 3 hours in Richfield, and it was a fantastic meeting for those that attended.
Well, it's well attended, too. There's about 80 people there. And we
met that request.
Yeah. And we not only talked about cougars, but also the coyote program and the fawn recruitment. It was an excellent meeting.
Okay, go ahead.
My next question is how many states issue permits like we do, and how many of them have open permits over the counter? Is there any other states that do what we do?
It's all over the board. California doesn't allow.
I realize California, but that's the People's Republic of California. I know.
And Colorado doesn't allow the hunting of cougars with hounds. No. Arizona.
That's bears.
Bears, okay. Arizona has a year-round season, but they have very few hunters, and there are also some restrictions on hounds down there. So it's kind of all over the place.
But pretty much all of our surrounding states have open cougar tags, like Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, Nevada.
Montana has a pretty aggressive cougar management program, though.
Right.
But it's...
Wyoming's is very similar to ours in terms of issuing tags. They have some... Wyoming has some units that they manage for, you know, for a trophy experience and issue tags, and other units that are open very similar to the way we do. Idaho, last I knew, was a little more liberal. I think in some states you can actually tag a cougar with your deer tag if you
right.
have the opportunity.
Idaho has
so there's lots of variation out there. And
although
in
Idaho, don't they have? Isn't theirs managed by a quota though? I mean, it's even though you can buy a permit. These guys hunt up there, they'll know.
I don't know.
Nevada's
off the top
had
of my
a quota
head.
Over the years.
One more?
Mm-hmm. I wish you'd asked me these questions last week.
In the plan, and what I read, I constantly come across the need to make hunters understand the cougar to prey interactions.
Uh-huh.
What are they referring to? I think we all pretty much know
Kevin
and
I refer
interactions, don't we?
Yeah, Kevin, I'm going to defer that back to you. What you were part of that plan. Do you remember what they're referring to?
I guess you'd have to put that in context and where in the plan it talks about that. So
now, some of the goals and stuff are to start having articles in sportsmen's magazines, and it named several, and in meetings, to explain the cougar-prey interactions to hunters.
I would guess what that's referring to is that typically with most predators that there's a relationship that if the prey base declines, then there's a lag effect and the predators themselves will fall, their population will decline, you know, maybe a year later, year to two later. And as the prey increases, then the predators will increase. But typically, in most cases, predators don't wipe out their prey because that doesn't make any sense to them. You know, to biologically or evolutionary for them to do that. So I would guess that's what that's referring to. Although in the first cougar plan, there was an article written by Dr. Mike Wolf. It talked about the predator pit, which might change that, where if you have multiple prey species and and multiple predators, it kind of changes the dynamic. But maybe that's what they're referring to, is just that relationship between multiple prey, multiple predators, or single, vice versa, whatever. So,
thank you. I'll decease.
Don't decease. Desist is better.
Okay. All right, we'll entertain any questions from the public. Scott?
Scott Christensen, Lowell, Utah. Of the plan, is there areas that aren't meeting the quotas or the objectives on the fill in the state?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. By how far do we know a percentage of those?
I don't have a spreadsheet here that will show that tonight, but there are quite a few that aren't meeting it. But, you know, there's the opportunity for people to go and hunt, you know, and take those animals, but the quotas are set to a level that
but we're not hitting the quotas.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason we don't allow other forms of hunting? I mean, cougars are pretty tough to hunt if you don't get snow, if you don't have hounds or hire somebody to run hounds. For a guy like me that wants to possibly harvest a cougar, I've got to hire somebody. Is there other options we could explore, like snaring or trapping, in those areas we're not hitting the quotas anyways? Is that an option?
Certainly an option, and what I would do is defer that to the Cougar Advisory Board when they reopen the plan. And I know we've talked about that in the past. In fact, we've had several proposals over the years that have never met the public support over, you know, a large percent of the public to support that. Utah Trappers Association, in fact, proposed that to me probably back about 1989, you know, so we've been talking about that long. I would mention that I did have another harebrained idea besides raising the the permit fee on bobcats to 15, is that I suggested this year we have a spot and stock cougar season where that if somebody bought a anybody with a big game permit could also purchase a cougar spot and stock permit and harvest that during their big game season without the use of hounds. So we're talking about different ideas.
That was suggested and shut down at the last meeting.
DeLoss Christensen, Glenwood, Utah. Bill, when I heard your presentation a few weeks ago, I thought I understood the proposal to say that on the quota units that there was a way for hunters to purchase an extended or maybe even a year-round permit so that if they were in the field, whether it's during the deer hunt or elk hunt or whether it's in March, and they see a cougar, they can take that. Is that correct?
Right. On units that are harvest objective, anybody can go buy an over-the-counter permit, and if they're out in the field, they're able to, you know, go out and harvest a lion that way. Some of those units, though, will end like June, I believe it's June 2nd or something, but some of them extend clear, almost year-round. But, yeah, you're right.
Mm-hmm. So, Cordell, that may get to some of what I think we'd all like to see, maybe a little more liberal issue there, but I wanted mm-hmm. to bring that up. Anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if there's no more questions, we'll move to the comment cards. You can go ahead. Okay, looks like Scott Christensen's first.
I'd like to make the comment that we look at the recommendation of on areas that aren't hitting their quotas consistently, that we open up other forms of harvesting those cats. I certainly want to protect the resource and don't want to overdo it, but there's other ways to harvest and give sportsmen other opportunities if they don't have the ability or the means to hire. There's ways that's done it. I've seen it done quite a bit in New Mexico. With trail cams and whatnot, the success is pretty high on actually pinpointing the cat they want to catch. They're pretty habitual. It does take time, but it is possible. So that's my comment.
Thanks, Scott. Yeah. Dan Cockane.
My name's Dan Cockane. I'm the president of the Utah Houndsmen Association, and I've also been asked to represent the Sam Pete Houndsmen tonight. I first want to say I appreciate these guys and their willingness to work with us, but I think that we need to point out a huge failure on the part of the division. And they've agreed, Leslie and Bill both. The Wildlife Board referred this back to them a year ago to work through this very confusing management plan that that really no one understands. And we began working on it May 19th. That's the first time that the Cougar Advisory Board was called together. And then at that time it wasn't the complete group. So we had one meeting, came to some conclusions, and then between that date and July 9th, I believe, is when there was a change in personnel in the division, and that plan was scrapped. A new plan was presented to just a few of us. There was the Utah Houndsmen, the Utah Wildlife Cooperative, I believe, and the SFW. I don't believe that's time enough to work through this confusing plan, and it's still confusing, and it contradicts itself, and we can't change the past, but we certainly need to fix it in the future. We agree that there are places where we need to keep the cougar numbers in check because the other species aren't at the management levels that we've chosen. Whether those are right or wrong, I don't know. But there's also areas where we're managing cougars. They're called cougar management areas, and we believe that they should be managed so that we can have some cougars. It's a world-class animal. It's on the level of the lions and the tigers in Africa, and people will come from all over the world to hunt them. And you know, the first lines in the cougar management plan is from the settlement of the territory to 1966. We persecuted them as vermin, and there are many who still would like to do that. And we just are saying that we don't need to do that. We can have cougars, and we can have a quality hunt, and we can take care of livestock, and we can take care of the big game, and we've worked through ways to do that. But a wholesale change of part of the plan doesn't work. It's a complicated process, and it all needs to be worked through. The way it's presented right now, there's a line that says we want to go back to unit by unit, which the big game asked us, the board asked to do, and they asked to simplify the plan, but we didn't simplify it. We said we want to have about a 40% female harvest, which the science says that's about right, but then when you go to the chart that shows how do we calculate those tags, how do we adjust it, we're back to the adult. It's confusing. The way it's at right now is it's not ready for prime time. It doesn't work. It makes some of the populations vulnerable. It makes others where there won't be any much harvest done. So we would ask you, and if you haven't received the letter, have a copy, but we would ask you to reject the plan as it's presented. We need to fix some of the things in it, and we don't need to throw the whole thing out, but we agree it should be based on a unit by unit. But it should make sense. We would ask for a female subquota on the cougar management units. In lieu of that, we'd ask that those cougar management units all go to limited entry. So we don't have this, you have an opportunity to kill a nice lion, but only for a certain time, and after that, it's a free-for-all, and I don't know if you've heard much about what happened to Book Cliffs, but basically when it went to predator management this year, and same with the San Juan, but they were, if you went out there at midnight, you could find five or six hired guides or whatever they are sitting on a lion track waiting for daylight for a client. It was just awful. And we're trying to promote young people in the sport and you know, getting them in the woods, and you take them in the woods and there's seven or eight guys out there sitting on a lion track and that outfitter's making $4,000 or $5,000 on that lion. You can't blame him for that, but it's created chaos. They did really well. They killed a lot of tom lions out there on the Book Cliffs, but at the end of the season they killed all females. There weren't any toms left. And we feel that we can have these lions. What we have done is created chaos. If we can let these lions build their territory and grow up a little bit, the research shows they don't have near the problem with livestock. We don't have near the problem with a big game. It's these young transient that are moving in, and you know, at the lion conference they just had in Cedar City, one of the guys from Washington said, you know, you kill one lion and three come to the funeral and they stay. And that's because we have this system where it's a competition. As soon as that opens, if you don't hurry and go kill something, you miss out on all your opportunity. If we just level it out, let the cougar management areas be limited entry, let the predator management areas be harvest objective. Anyone can buy a tag. If they see a lion, they want to kill it. It's year-round. It answers both of the things without a wholesale one way or the other. So we'd ask you to either vote for a female subquota or change those to limited, the splits to limited entry, and then also ask them to consider all the females in the harvest, which the plan doesn't call for right now. The other thing that I believe this RAC voted for last year, and then it got lost in the shuffle at the big game board meeting, when the reason that the director asked that the board vote to reopen this plan and fix it so that everyone could understand it. But the GPS location of all the harvest, that came to us from law enforcement, from the COs, as another tool in their belt to deal with, you know, poaching and taking a lion off a limited entry unit and claiming it on a harvest objective, and that got lost in the shelf. And we'd ask that you send that request back to the big game board. Thank you.
And I think you said it there, but maybe I misunderstood you. So the Utah houndsman would not object to buying a cougar permit over the counter for big game hunts. You can only kill them during the big game hunt. Is that what you just said?
On the predator management units, that's the way it is right now.
Okay, I'm not talking about predator management. I'm talking statewide.
No, not statewide. We'd object to that. We don't have a female subquota, and we're not counting the juvenile or the subadult females. And when you see a cougar on the hillside, you're going to see it for about 10, 15 seconds at most. I've been in the woods my whole life, you know, 50, 60 days a year hunting lions, and I honestly can tell you I've seen one in the headlights in all those years. So it doesn't happen that often, and there's not a chance to decide, is this a trophy or is it just, does it have spots? Who knows? We wouldn't support that any further than it already is allowed.
Sam?
Yeah, obviously, your passion is lions, and my passion is mule deer. And we're going to collide
but
at
no,
that
that's,
point.
But no, that's not true. Well, my passion is ducks and geese and fish and mule deer and elk and bighorn sheep and lions and bears, and I like dogs. And so we're not going to clash. We can work together, and we need to.
Let me ask you this. How would you feel if we use the deer population to determine the number of lion tags? And if we're 15% over objective, we'll increase lion tags on that unit.
That's exactly
as long as it's below or at objective, we'll keep that number up where it is and keep and quit reducing. The predator management plan or the lion plan, when you read it, go through it, and I've done the math. The silly questions I ask all have to do with a formula, not necessarily a formula, but just an equation of what's happening with that plan. And when you go through and use the data in that plan, we're managing cougars to increase by 16% every year. We're killing in the amount of meat they eat a day, 60,500 deer a year to feed lions. That's excessive, in my opinion.
Well, you know what? When I was young, and when my dad was young, and my grandpa was young, and the mule and the deer hunting was great, those cougars were eating just as many deer. But we weren't killing as many with our bumpers. We didn't have rifles. We could shoot a 2-point from 800 yards. And so there are a lot more factors than just that lion eating deer. I eat deer. You eat deer. The lions eat deer. I mean, there's no question. The lions eat coyotes and they eat skunks and they eat porcupines and they eat rabbits. Also, they eat horses and they eat sheep and they eat cows and so, I'm not here to say that the lions are not part of the reason that the mule deers have declined, but they're not the only reason. They've always been on the landscape, and if you talk to any houndsman that's been on the mountain much, the numbers of lions are getting less and less and less. The reason we're killing less is because they're not there. I mean, there's not a lion behind every bush. There just isn't.
No, and I'll agree with that. I spend an awful lot of time out as well, and I haven't seen lions visually during the day. The only time I've really seen them is in the headlights. And when I see their population estimates and things like that, it just amazes me that, you know, where they get these numbers. I have no idea.
We haven't done a population estimate since 1999, and so... You know, who knows what's happened with their habitat, with the drought, with fires, with all that thing. So we don't, no one knows. We don't know how many lions are out there, but if you just take the guys that are out there looking for a track in the snow, and so you take a year like last year, and the majority of the lion hunters are hunting in the snow. We had very little snow. Sure, the take is going to be down. The other thing that was talked about is trapping and snaring, which it may be a viable method for taking a cougar, but it totally eliminates dogs. When a full-grown trained dog is worth anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 right now. A bobcat trap, you can take him out of, and there's probably not much damage, and I've done that a lot. But a lion trap or a snare, that's a dead dog. And so it'll drive the houndsman right off the range, and then we'll take very, very few lions.
Okay, so you feel the cougar population is in decline, and the reason is the hunting methods and the management plan that is in place at this time.
No, I think there's a lot of factors. I think there's a lot of factors, but I do know if we keep killing the females and orphaning kittens, that happens because those kittens aren't with those females, and you know, the study they did just down in Montrose, about 60% of the female collared female lions orphaned at least one kitten. Me personally, I've never seen more than two kittens with a lion, but the indicator of a declining population, in the book it's called, I don't know, Kevin, can you help me with that? What's the name of the book that we base the plan on? Managing Cougars in North America, or I believe that's the name of the book. It talks about it in the plan and that it's available from DWR. One of the indicators of a declining population is an increase in females in the harvest and that age class going down, and we're seeing it year after year. I don't know what it is this year because it's not published yet, but all the scientific indicators are it's a declining population. We just like to keep something out there for us to hunt. We don't want everything, but we sure would like something.
Come south. There's lots of cougars.
Well, I hunt the LaSalle a lot, and there's not the cougars there was 10 years ago, nowhere near.
Nor the deer.
No, nor the deer. You're right. They have to have something to eat.
Darren, we appreciate you coming and taking the extra time and answering questions, and you've done an excellent job, and we appreciate you being here. Thank you. More comment cards. Let's see. Greg McGregor.
Greg McGregor, Santa Clara, Utah. I think I have an answer. We take all the round up all the cougars and send them out to Southwest Desert and have them eat the horses out there. There's a lot of horses out there. I represent this evening a conglomerate of individuals and representatives of Sportsman's Group that have come together called Partners in Pine Valley. And what I would like to address this evening is, in particular, is the Pine Valley unit. Our mission statement is concerned citizens and advocates for the enhancement and conservation of habitat and wildlife on the Pine Valley Wildlife Unit, thus preserving our hunting rights and traditions for generations to come. Just an idea of those making up this committee, we have representation of the following: Mueller Foundation, RMEF, SFW, the County Commissioners, the BLM, the National Wild Turkey Federation, Southern Safari Club International of Southern Utah, the NRA, and Stockman. So we've got a very good input regarding our proposal here this evening. Now, as I hear the conversation tonight, I believe that in front of us, and meeting not necessarily at this hour, but at this time, there is a committee in Salt Lake City addressing the new five-year mule deer plan. And as it doesn't take some of you with a very high IQ, such as myself, to discern that mule deer in this state should be the number one priority for the division and for all involved, because that is the bread and butter of what this state is when it comes to hunting. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that. On the Pine Valley unit, the management objective for deer, and I'll get to this all factors into what lions have to do with this. The management objective is 16,000. We're at 12,000. That's 25%. It's been at 12,000 for a while. Okay, we sent a letter to the Mule Deer Committee, making recommendations on what to do about that. About 15 years ago, I think the Pine Valley had about 12 limited entry permit tags for lions on the Pine Valley. It took a couple years, but sportsmen convinced the division to open that up to a quota. 40 cougars were killed in the very next year. 40 again the year after that. And it went down to about 35, thereabouts. Now it's somewhat leveled off. And I believe the recommendations this year for the Pine Valley, and I find it a little bit absurd that we have 10 management or objective tags on the southern part of the Pine Valley. Recall it's being split. And 8, which I don't know how many are quota and how many are permit, on the northern unit. And they say, it has been said, that that is to protect the bighorn sheep. What about the mule deer? What about the mule deer? I think that every place in this state right now ought to be a wildlife management objective for whatever predator there is. I mean, we go after the coyotes. We just need to make sure, and we're not out to eradicate any species. We just want them controlled to the point where another species doesn't leave us in favor of another one. And we don't want that to happen. We're in favor. I called 3 houndsmen today, and they were in favor of what we had to propose tonight. Huntable area. You look at the Pine Valley unit, and I asked these houndsmen, what is the percentage of huntable area on the Pine Valley? 20% maybe huntable. That means there's 80% that could house cougars. I think it's a hatchery for cougars. They get taken. The others from that area come back and take in and progress and take over dominion of the area of those toms that have been taken out of there. And so there's we're down to what it is the total quota on the Pine Valley now is 18. The surrounding states, I believe Arizona, I think you can take a cat with your license. I know in Nevada you can, in Idaho you can. You can take a cat and give up your deer tag in order to take a cat. We just think, and we would like to propose to the division tonight and to this RAC, and by the way, thanks for being audience to me and my representation here this evening. We appreciate your time and effort on our behalf. We would like to make a recommendation that the Pine Valley unit as a whole have 25 quota tags, split however you see fit between the north and the south, but I think it is, we submit to you that deer are every bit as important as the sheep on there and need to be protected. Thanks for your time. Any questions? Thank you.
DeLoss Christensen. Thank you, Greg.
Got a call this morning from Byron Bateman, the chairman or president of SFW. SFW and their chapter heads, who are the voting body for that organization, met about 2 weeks ago. Mr. Bates was there. The Houndsman representatives were there. We went through this plan quite extensively. And Mr. Bateman apologized that he can't be here this evening. He asked me to tell you that SFW chapter heads unanimously support the plan as it has been written by the division tonight. Thanks.
Thank you, DeLoss. That's all the comment cards, I believe. Is that correct for this section? Do you have any comments from the RAC? I guess it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, we're talking about 2015, and then in the meantime, we're going to open the plan up again, right, and meet with all these parties of interest. So the results of that plan would come forth in 2016?
Right. We'll bring those before you next year after the Cougar Advisory Board meets and they revise the plan. And I do apologize that we weren't able to get it, you know, a good review of it done this year. We just had some personnel issues where it didn't happen. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, that's where we are. And, but, yeah, we're looking at a 2014-2015 season. And then for the 2015-2016 season, we hopefully will have the new plan in place.
Now, with that committee that's working on that, is that committee set, or is there opportunities? For instance, we have a new group apparently in southern Utah, the Pine Valley Friends.
We haven't put that group together yet.
Okay.
We'll get through this. Leslie's only been on less than a month, and so, you know, John left fairly abruptly, and we just haven't had, you know, we're just getting started on that. So,
thank you, Bill. Mm-hmm. Any comments, Sam?
I'd just kind of like to hear from Rusty on what's going on with the, he's on this mule deer committee, on if anything about lions is being addressed through that committee, as I was told it would be.
It has come up with the population strategies. It's basically with the whatever the Cougar plan dictates, pretty much is how it is. The population objectives and or the predator management plans, I guess, dictate when the more cougars are harvested or not. But it'd be basically up to the cougar plan.
The predator plan.
Yeah.
Predator management policy, which isn't the cougar plan.
Okay, one of the things that came up last year, and one of the reasons that this was reopened, was that we requested that on the premium deer units, that they be treated like the bighorn sheep units and have unlimited tags. And this is the point I was trying to make and was supposed to be discussed at the mule deer meetings on whether or not we are going to put any emphasis on these premium units that we clout as far as any cougar management, especially for them.
Yeah, I don't know if that's been discussed. Same.
But there's still a lot.
Yeah,
a
we've
lot
still got several.
Process,
yeah.
So.
Any other comments from the right? Okay. Claire?
Yeah, just addressing Greg's comments on the Pine Valley, where I've lived down there all my life and have friends and whose fathers and uncles have been guides. 17 tags on those two hunts is awfully small for a unit that big. I mean, that unit runs from Cedar City to St. George and everything west of the border. It's a huge area with a lot of deer and a lot of cougars. And I don't know that I'm qualified to propose how many we increase it, but my recommendation is 17 is awfully small for that unit.
As you're thinking about putting together a motion, there's a couple things I just wanted to bring up to remind you. There were some discussions here tonight about requiring GPS locations on every harvest. There was discussions on adding back into the plan the female quota. And then we had the presentation on the Pine Valley unit to increase the number of tags to 25. Did I miss anything else? Did I miss something, DeLoss?
I wanted to address Sam's question when you do that, if I may.
Please do.
You want me to come to the mic?
Please come to the mic and state your name again just so we get in the minutes.
DeLoss Christensen, Glenwood, Utah. Sam, let me kind of explain to you a little more about the Mule Deer Committee and where we're at. I'm on the committee as well with Rusty. We have gone through different phases of the plan. We're finished with the population discussions. We're finished talking about predators. If you want that issue addressed by that group, you'll need to become proactive in communicating that specific need with the chairman of that committee, Mr. Shannon, because we will not be talking about that anymore unless you create that discussion. It won't come up in our meeting. Is that okay?
Thank you, DeLoss. Okay, are we ready to formulate a motion?
One question. Do we know how many permits there were for Pine Valley last year?
There was 12 on the entire unit last year, so we're increasing from 12 to 18. And just so you know what harvest has looked like for the last few years, last year we had 12, we only killed 10. Back in 2011, we did reach the quota when it was 15, but other than that, we haven't been even meeting the permits that we have allocated. So that's why we thought if we split it into two units and raised it to 18, that would be ample.
And these are all quota tags, true?
In the past, the Pine Valley has been a split.
Bill, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I hope it's okay to ask us. I forgot to address the female subquota issue when I was giving my presentation, and if it would be okay to just explain.
Please do while we're trying to get a proposal.
By changing from a three-year rotation on permits to an annual, and also by including, as I stated in the presentation, we did consider all females in our recommendations this year. We did look at the 40%, level rather than just the 17 to 22%. By doing that, if we still had a female subquota, we would be giving double protection to cougars. It's repetitive, and so we would oppose the female subquota if you go with what we've recommended tonight.
Bill? So currently, in order to increase tags, female harvest is above 20%. We increase 10%. 23%, we increased 20%. This is all in that plan.
Right. And
it's very confusing.
It is. And that we need to go through and change the plan. And hopefully the new Cougar Advisory Board will come up with something that is understandable for us.
And the only thing you'll dear are in here is if a unit gets severely lower, like 85%, I don't remember the exact
right.
number, that we will make it a predator management.
Right. There's two different criteria. One is if it's, I believe it's 85% over a three-year period, or I should have memorized those before I came.
So the confusion here is that's not addressed in the Cougar plan. That's part of the predator management
right.
policy. And, mm-hmm. and what the predator management policy says is that if adult survival drops below 85% on an average over 3 years, then that's a trigger to put a unit into predator management. Or if it drops below 80% on a single year, that's another trigger mm-hmm. to consider a unit going into a predator management. So that's always been a confusing issue. The predator management policy is kept separate from the Cougar management plan with good reason, because it adds confusion, but it also allows some of the biology to be considered more in the plan,
right.
and separates the predator side of that issue. So
right.
More than one way to skin a cat, that's the way we've decided to do it, and maybe it's the right way, maybe it's not.
Yeah. And we're comfortable with our recommendations that the same people that manage cougars in the state manage deer, and that's why we came up with what we did.
You ready, Sam? Are you going to make the...
Okay, I'll make the motion that we accept the Cougar Management Plan revision and 2015 recommendations as presented.
Okay.
Period.
No GPS.
No GPS. I'm going to let these guys see if they want to amend.
Do we have a second? We have a motion to accept the plan as presented and a second by Rusty. Do we have discussion on the motion?
Because this is cougars and it's confusing. This is getting opened back up. When's it getting opened back up again so you guys can go through and make this next year?
So I think it's fair to say that this year, because of the changes we had in personnel and whatnot, hopefully Bill won't get too mad at me for this. I think this year's recommendation, it could be classified as a Band-Aid to buy us a year in order to do what the board asked us to do, and we failed to accomplish this year because of some extenuating circumstances. Next year, I think you'll see a much more extensive revision of the plan, and with everybody, you know, all the interested parties involved.
Okay, if we don't have any further discussion, we're going to vote on the motion. All those in favor? It looks like it passes unanimously. There's a lot of discussion. Okay, let's move on to the next item.
I have to mention this has been a long day for me after going through the Crow meeting this morning, and this is hopefully I'll make sense with what I'm talking about here. The next item that we're going to talk about is the Bobcat and Fur Bear proclamations. And the main thing we're going to focus on are bobcats. And if you look at if you remember in the Bobcat plan, we have four different performance targets that we use to adjust harvest. Percent young, we're looking at 42 to 56% as our target range, 65 to 72% adult survival, and we get that from sectioning the teeth. Percent females, we're looking from 41 to 45%, and set days per bobcat, and we get to that through the survey that we do, is 177 to 220. This year, we were able to meet three of those performance targets, the percent juveniles, percent survival, percent females. The set days per bobcat didn't actually come within the range, but it's trending in the right direction. And according to the guidance from the plan, is if more than two of the performance targets are outside of the range, what that does is takes us back to where the original recommendations we had, which are six bobcat tags per individual with a season running from the third Wednesday in November to the second Sunday in February with no cap on the number of tags sold. And so that's our recommendation this year. So hopefully people have a lot more opportunity. Last year we had a cap set at 4,600. People could only have three bobcat tags. And so this year they'll be able to buy six and we'll have no cap on the number of permits we issue. With other fur bearers, there are no changes. Season dates for beaver and mink go from September 27th to April 7th. Badgers, gray fox, et cetera, go till February 2nd. Martin also goes to February 2nd. And that is it.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions from the rack? Rusty.
The February 8th closing, does that seem early? Aren't they after good hides, and would the hides still be good for a month or so later?
The February closing, that extends, it's been that way clear since 1980 as well. We've varied a few weeks here, backwards and forwards, depending on how bobcats are doing. And actually, it's based a lot on the trend of cottontail rabbits, because bobcats track cottontails, but we've got ranged from as short as a 4-week season, but the second Saturday in February is the latest we've ever gone. And I know we've had some discussions. The Utah Trappers Association has recommended we go later because they feel that we can get more toms if we trap later. I remember years ago I did research when I was a fur bear biologist, and at that time, the percent of females in the harvest tended to trend upwards the longer the season went, which is a little bit counterintuitive. We looked at that question again this year since they're going to have that proposal tonight, and we didn't find any significant difference in the, in changes in ages or sexes at the end of the season versus the first of the season. So, I guess it might have just been an artifact of our data previously, and over long term, maybe it wouldn't hold out. But I think according to plan, we would like to stick with that season length. If it was moved forward or back, that's within the RACs and the board's prerogative, but we don't want to lengthen the season any more than that.
So you're saying if you had it 2 weeks later, maybe take 2 weeks off
the front end. 2 weeks off the front end. But on the other hand, the trade-off has always been the houndsmen want to get out and hunt bobcats over the Thanksgiving holiday. And so that's why we've started in November, just prior to Thanksgiving, to give them that opportunity. And also, a lot of kids are out of school. If they're going to college and they like to trap from during the Christmas break. So, some of them start as early as Thanksgiving getting their traps out. So it's a trade-off both ways. But pelts are prime during that entire length of the season.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have any questions down at this end? Okay, we'll turn time to the audience for questions. All right. Looks like we'll go to the cards. Again, we have a number of cards. There's only one that wants to address from the Utah Trappers, and that is Kent.
Again, Mr. Chair, Rack, we as the Utah Trappers Association support the proposal as a whole. However, we would propose an extension and ask support in proposing the extension. And our rationale is we believe that through selective harvest, it would actually benefit females and kitten survival rates. The toms are more active the later in the season you go, and most trappers prefer, as the houndsmen prefer to go after the large toms, most trappers prefer to go after selectively bigger toms. We believe that would be the case in this. I don't know about the historical data. I can go back to some of the old boys, if you want to use the old school stuff, and go back 70, 80 years, and they'll tell you that'll happen with the harvest. And these are seasoned cat trappers. We do believe that through selective harvest, most of the trappers would prefer to turn a kitten loose to go after a larger tom. They would prefer to turn a tidbelly loose to go after a larger tom. It's just the name of the game. And therefore, like I say, we believe that it would promote selective harvest, more selective harvest, ultimately helping out the females and the juvenile survivability rate. Again, just one comment. The mature toms that they're after are more active later in the season. So we would ask that you support a two-week extension. Thank you.
Thank you. And just for the record, I have 10 additional cards. Each of these in general state that they support the Utah Trapper Association in their comments, which also includes the recommendation to extend the hunt 2 weeks at the tail end of the season. And that looks like all the comment cards to come forward. Do we have any comments from the RAC?
Spurs a question. How does the division feel about two-week extensions?
Well, let's just not here to talk to tonight, but I think that you need to weigh the desires of the houndsmen against the trappers. And, I think that's certainly something that's possible to extend it 2 weeks as long as you keep the season length is fine, but just realize that how you move it, you're affecting a different part of the clientele that uses the resource. So that's your job is, biologically we can do it. Socially, you got to figure out who you're benefiting. So,
looks like the houndsman left. Is there anybody here to represent them?
I have a question. Is there a reason why we just can't lengthen it? I mean, I know you kind of talked about it, but is there like a legislative reason we can't just on 2 weeks?
There's not a legislative reason, although the plan calls for that season length. But I think you need to take a look at, we went to a pretty huge jump to go from three permits per person to six, when going from a cap of 4,600 to, what are we going to sell this year, 15, 20,000? I don't know. We've been trying to guess how many we're going to sell this year. So do we have the Bobcat resources to support that plus 2 more weeks? Personally, as my recommendation as a biologist is, I think we ought to go with the recommendations we've made. I would be very uncomfortable adding 2 more weeks given the drastic change we're making just with doubling the number of permits per person and going, and the, more importantly, going to an unlimited cap. That is huge. So if we would have been three with a limit of 4,600, I'd say make it 10 weeks longer. I don't care.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
But with the changes we're making, no, I do not support adding 2 weeks on. But if you want to adjust it, that's up to you guys. It's a social issue.
I have a question for these guys that trap. You guys actually turn those things loose if it's not the one you want? You guys are just bragging now? Because I tried trapping them and couldn't catch any.
Okay, please come to the mic. Restate your name again so we have it.
Kent Fowden, Utah Trappers. One thing, the data over the years has proven that we've yet to harvest more than 3,400 cats. So I just wanted to shed light on that. Even with six tags, they haven't.
How long have they had six tags?
It's been off and on.
Years ago.
It's been decreasing the last, Kevin, how many years ago was it? Do you recall?
I think five or six years ago we had, it was when we had six tags per individual the last time. But I will point out, Cannon, just to, put in context the comment you made, it was the year after we trapped 3,500 that we ended up having to reduce tags down to, from six and start moving down because the metrics had dropped after we did harvest that many. So true, that's the most we've ever harvested, but the data indicated that when we did harvest that many, we impacted the population. And that's not the only reason. There's also the time, rabbits started crashing and everything else. Lots of things started happening right then. So it's probably not the only reason, but it did probably contribute.
Thank you.
So if you had your option of not changing it or moving it 2 weeks later into December and later in February, which would you guys prefer?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question because there's other peoples that enjoy the harvest. I can't speak for the houndsmen. There's other sportsmen. There's callers that, for the same reason, they like to get out on Thanksgiving. There's not just trappers that are harvesting these cats. There's callers. There's a multitude of people that are harvesting. So I can't speak to them. I just think there's a balance. There could be a balance. Be it a week extension, just something to allow an opportunity to exercise more of a selective harvest. Thanks.
Hey, Dave, I just have a comment. And looking at this like a biologist, a lot of times you make a change. What you do is you look at years to come and see how that changes, what happens. When you start piling change upon change, a lot of times you kind of lose that. And so I guess my comment, I guess, is that it's probably too much in 1 year to start adding too many things like that. You might not know what Bill's proposing now is going to work out or not. So I guess I'd be kind of a little bit leery about adding that additional season change to what's already been proposed.
Okay, good comment. Are you ready to put a motion?
I'd like to make a motion to accept the recommendations of the DWR on the bobcat, with the exception of adding 1 week to the close date on the hunt.
Okay.
That for bobcat and all the other fur bearer stuff.
Just bobcat.
Just bobcat.
Just bobcat. Is that what you guys are, the whole thing? Just bobcat.
But your recommendation to accept the proposal is for all of the fur bearer recommendations, mm-hmm. with the exception of adding 1 week to the.
Correct.
Okay.
Do we have a second on Rusty's motion? We have a second by Sam. We have discussion on the motion. Brian.
I just want to be clear, you're talking about adding 7 calendar days to that. You're not taking that off the front, you're just adding 7 calendar days. Okay.
Any further discussion? Okay, let's vote. All those in favor? You got a count? All those opposed? 5-3, is that correct? Looks like the motion carries 5-3. Okay, the next action item is the additional turkey transplant sites, and Jason Robinson will present that.
Don't blink on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we talked about this a little bit, Kevin did at the first of the meeting, so hopefully this will be a kind of a quick agenda item. Excuse me, sorry. So last RAC meeting, we brought the turkey transplant list here before the RAC, and the RAC asked us to add 7 additional sites. These sites are Marysville Canyon, Birchville, City Creek, Mammoth Creek, Upper Sevier, Minersville, and Coal Creek. So we presented those to the Wildlife Board, but what our recommendation was is, go ahead.
Yeah, that one should be, instead of Birchville, it should be Birch Creek out of Circleville. I made the recommendation, so that should be Birch Creek, not Birchville.
Okay. Well, hopefully we got that corrected. I'll look at that to make sure that it's Birch Creek. So what we presented to the board, because those 7 sites had not gone through the formal process that's in place, the RDCC that we talked about earlier, we couldn't actually add those sites to the transplant list. So the board approved the 231 sites that we proposed and then asked us to evaluate those 7 sites. We've since done that. The DWR regional folks have looked at those sites. And so what we've came to you tonight with is a recommendation that we would like to add the 7 sites to the statewide turkey transplant, so it increased that total number by 7. So we, after that board meeting, we submitted those 7 sites to RDCC, which would go through the local governments as required by wildlife code. We have not received any comments. That comment period is open till Friday, but we can present it to you here tonight, and then if you guys accept it, then we would present it to the board to be added to that statewide transplant list. That's all I had. Thanks.
So just to be clear, what you're being asked to do is accept your own proposal.
Correct.
Should be pretty easy, which was accepted unanimously when you gave it to us. So.
Okay, my guest to follow protocol. Is there any questions from the audience?
I have a question.
Okay, Dale.
Why do we have to accept public comment on areas that already historically have turkeys in them and have had turkeys for years? Why do we need to have a comment period to transplant turkeys to supplement a flock that's there, I guess, is what my question is.
So through wildlife code that's established, anytime we move big game, turkeys or sensitive species, the requirement by law is to have that go through the RAC and board process as well as this RDCC process. So that's a stipulation that's in place already that we've done in the past and will continue to do. And it includes both existing sites and new sites. So anytime we move birds or big game or other species to a site, then we take it through that process.
So the answer, Dale, is because the legislature said so, and that's who our boss is.
That's the short, sweet answer. Thanks, Kevin.
So when you transplant the goats from the Tushers over to the Dutton, you have to go through this comment period?
I'll let Kevin address that.
Yes, when we made the proposal to move, we didn't move them from the Tushers to the Dutton. We actually moved them from Willard Peak to the Dutton. Yes, we did. It did go through the RDCC process. Anytime we move, like Jason said, any big game species, any sensitive species, or turkeys, we have to go through this comment period or the RDCC process.
Any additional comments? We don't have any cards. I just suggest that when you make your motion that you make the correction of Birch Creek in the motion so we get that on the record.
Okay, I will make the motion that we accept DWR's proposal as presented except for the change in the name. It should be Birch Creek.
Do we have a second? We have a second from Lane. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? Passes unanimous. Okay. Okay, on this next item, Kevin's asked that he give us some information prior to Jason's presentation.
Yeah, so just briefly, this is a little bit different than I've ever seen in a RAC meeting. What we've got here is the Forest Service came to us a while ago. They've, a lot of you are familiar, there's been this big Monroe Mountain working group that's been working on things for quite a while, and with the objective of increasing aspen on Monroe Mountain, which when aspen gets increased, everything wins. There's more forage for livestock. There's better deer and elk habitat. It's a good thing all around. But given the regulations that the Forest Service has to follow, they have to take this through a NEPA process. And because wildlife are part of it, and they don't have management authority over wildlife, they asked if, prior to going through their own public process, if they could get an endorsement, essentially, of a document that's been worked out by this Monroe Mountain Working Group that deals with, you know, when and where are we going to control, and how might we control elk to support aspen in a very short-term basis. And so what you've got, Jason will present the presentation. There was a letter that I hope you saw in your packet that was written for the board to then submit. If this all gets through the process, the Wildlife Board Chairman will sign that letter, and then the Forest Service will then have that through their own public process to say, you know, we've worked with the management agency, and they're at least supporting in concept what we're proposing. So with that, with some of that background, and Jason may cover all that again, but just because this is a little bit different, I thought it'd worth kind of introducing why we're doing this. And with that, I'll turn the time over to Jason.
Yes. Thank you for having me. Once again, my name is Jason Kling. I'm the district ranger on the Richfield Ranger District, which is part of the Fish Lake National Forest. And as Kevin talked about, we're currently in the NEPA process, putting together an environmental impact statement, NEIS, for a project that aimed and with the goal of improving aspen ecosystems on Monroe Mountain. Shouldn't be anything new. We all know where Monroe Mountain is. Second page there is just a vicinity map of our project area. Talked a little bit about Monroe Mountain Working Group. There are some of the members of the Monroe Mountain Working Group. Some of them are here with me tonight. Sevier County Commissioner Tudor Ogden. Byron's not here, but DeLoss Christensen has been really the local person that's been participating in this effort and a part of that Monroe Mountain Working Group. Also have Rain Bagley here, a permittee on Monroe Mountain. You take a look at that list, and there's a good representation from livestock side as well as the wildlife side, our local elected officials, the division, forestry, fire, state lands, some of our researchers from BYU, Utah State, etc. I'll give you just a little bit of history on how we got to the Monroe Mountain Working Group. Some of you may be aware, 2008, 9, and 10, there was a statewide collaborative Utah Forest Aspen Restoration Working Group that was put together, and they were tasked to develop and put together some aspen restoration guidelines that could be applied and implemented on the various national forests here in the state of Utah. In 2010, when those guidelines came out, that statewide aspen group was looking for some pilot projects to take those aspen restoration guidelines on a test run. There was a few projects that were selected across the state of Utah, one of those being Monroe Mountain in Aspen on that area. And so since 2010, when this Monroe Mountain Working Group got formed and was put together, two projects have come from that process. And this first one was a livestock improvement project that involved putting in some new pipelines, some troughs, some new fences, with the goal of giving us some more management flexibility and options to make some adjustments in our livestock grazing management to be able to provide some rest be able to change seasons of use, change rotation schedules. And so there was three allotments. Two of those were cattle, one was sheep. We were able to combine those three. So now we were able to put sheep where we've had cows and cows where we've had sheep. And to be able to put that, make that be possible, we had to put in some of these, like I mentioned, fences and some water developments. That went through our NEPA process successfully. We started implementing that this last year and is being finished as we speak. And we think that that's going to be a big help and indirectly benefit our Aspen. Expensive project, upwards of about $750,000. And that funding came from Grazing Improvement Program, UPCD, permittees, Forest Service, a lot of partners to help make that happen, and we appreciate that. So some people may be asking, well, what's the big deal about Aspen? What benefits do Aspen really provide? Kevin mentioned about wildlife habitat, livestock habitat. Aspen ecosystems provide some of the highest forage and species diversity that you'll find in any ecosystem. Your highest tons per acre are usually found in your aspen areas, and so there's a huge benefit to wildlife as well as livestock. I talked about native species diversity, of course, hazardous fuels reductions. You know, if you look at aspen, they don't burn nearly as well as a conifer-dominated subalpine fir type area. And so as we go about doing prescribed burns and so forth to help improve aspen, there's that indirect benefit as it relates to fuels and fuels reduction and fire and public safety, firefighter safety, and so forth. Talking about wildlife as an example, this is a map that maybe all of you are familiar with. You know, the pink being, make sure I get the words right here, crucial summer elk habitat, the pink being substantial, the greens being more the winter. And you can see that, you know, Monroe Mountain provides a lot of, has potential and capability to provide a lot of really good habitat for elk. And there's also many other species that benefit from aspen. 2012, we had our Box Creek burn on Monroe Mountain. A few photos there, upper right-hand corner was during implementation as that burn was occurring. That upper left-hand corner, you can see the aspen coming back in, and that picture was taken by Craig Rasmussen, who's also here, just 6 weeks after that burn. So aspen's a species that really responds well after disturbance. With burning them and having your aspen, as I call it, you know, 2 or 3 feet tall, they're very, very susceptible to being browsed. Animals love to eat aspen, and they're very vulnerable until the aspen get to 6 or 7 feet tall, where they're above that height that animals can reach. And so we had some concerns with Box Creek and the pressure that may occur in there after that burn. And so once again, with some UPCD funding, some secure rural schools funding, we were able to purchase some fences and construct some fences around these aspen stands. 2 years later, it's absolutely amazing what is occurring inside and the improvement that has come from that fire. Fences, on the flip side, are very, very expensive, upwards of $5-6 a foot for materials and to construct them. And then if you want to factor in maintenance costs for an additional 4 to 6 years, they become very, very expensive. And really, in my opinion, is not a long-term solution. Not practical to get into a habit of fencing every time we do a prescribed burn. And so figuring out how can we do these burns and not feel like we have to fence everything has really been where the work is. As we move into this EIS and this larger aspen project, desired conditions, multi-height aspen. I like to, in simplified terms, call it, you know, we need some adults, we need some teenagers, and we need some young kids. And we got to have those young kids to be able to replace those adults. Aspen is a relatively short-lived tree. A 100-year-old aspen tree is pretty old. But if you don't have those young trees that can get to that 6 feet height to where they can escape being completely just browsed, you're not going to have that younger succession of trees to be able to replace those older trees when they die off. Biodiverse understories, fire regimes, to be able to perpetuate and to maintain these ecosystems. Don't focus too much on the colors, yellow, orange, green, and light green. Really, those are just aspen in different succession. But as you look at that, you can see that the aspen really makes up a large percentage of Monroe Mountain and is a large percentage of the type of habitat that is provided on Monroe Mountain. The outer green boundary is the National Forest boundary. And so this EIS that we're talking about really encompasses all of those aspen areas that you see there highlighted in those four different colors. Through assistance from the Monroe Mountain Working Group and a whole lot of monitoring over the last couple of years, not to say that there's not other contributors to aspen decline, but two of the biggest ones for Monroe, one is conifer encroachment, conifer expansion, and that's primarily just due to reduced fire frequency, less fire. These areas historically burned a lot more often, and then through fire suppression, these ecosystems from a fire perspective are really out of whack. And so we've got a high concentration of conifer. For those of you, all of you that enjoy the outdoors, you're familiar with these overgrown conifer areas that the sunlight never reaches the ground. You're crawling over, under, in between trees. Very little understory growth because everything's just so choked out. The resources, the space, the nutrients in the soils just aren't there. And then this other one is, I've mentioned, is this over-browsing. Through transects and cameras and Jody Gale from Utah State Extension, I think he told me he'd gone through like 40 or 50,000 photos looking at animals that eat aspen. And to no big surprise, cows, elk, deer, sheep all eat aspen. Not a huge shock there. That bottom left-hand corner picture is a picture of a White Ledges area just a few miles south of Manning Meadows Reservoir. We did a treatment there, did not fence it, and 20 years later, there's no aspen left. They were completely eaten, and they're gone, and what used to be a timber forest is now just covered in a few grasses. And so we would say that that's not what we want in the future. So as we are putting together this EIS, couple different alternatives that we've got. It's a variation of some fire and some mechanical treatments and some thinning around private lands, private property, so that we can implement some of those prescribed burns and keep them safe and effective and where we want them. For mechanical, we've talked about just going in and selectively thinning conifers, leaving the aspen, like that bottom right-hand picture. You can see on the bottom right-hand picture there, the left-hand side, we went in and thinned some conifers and left the aspen trees, and on the right-hand side of that picture, we didn't do any treatments, and you can see the difference. And so that the fire, let me back up here really quick, if I can find the button to back up. And so the fire and the mechanical was really to address that first underlying cause of the whole conifer encroachment. The second piece of that, the over-browsing, and I believe you all received a thresholds document that the Monroe Mountain Working Group put together, submitted to the Forest Service with a cover letter asking us to include that in our EIS and include it into our analysis and build it into our proposal. And so the idea here is after we do a burn, after we do some mechanical treatments, after we provide that disturbance, and we get that flush of new aspen, like after the Box Creek fire, the goal would be that we get at least 1,000 of those aspen trees to 6 feet height above that browse height. And we think that depending on the area, it's going to take anywhere from 4 to 6 years to get them to that height, depending on location and elevation and moisture and lots of different factors. And so if you need 1,000 trees per acre at 6 feet height, if you do a treatment and you got 5,000 sprouts to the acre, our tolerance is for a browse threshold is going to be lower than if you got 40,000 sprouts to the acre because you've got more aspen sprouts so you can tolerate a higher browse percentage to be able to get enough trees to that 6 feet height. And it was just a matter of some statistics and some math to figure out what those percentages would be. The hard part is if we get to those percentages, what are we going to do? And can we do it quick enough? Aspen, you know, after you do a burn, if they're not, if they're being overbrowsed, it's just a matter of time within 2, 3, 4 years, those aspen trees will eventually just run out of energy and will quit growing. And that's if they continue, if they're getting, you know, 90, 100% browse year after year after year, they're eventually not going to be able to sustain themselves. So it's important that we can, whatever our response options, whatever our adaptive management is, that we can be able to react quick enough. And so this next slide, I'll say that the Monroe Mountain Working Group spent a good 18 months working on this thresholds document and what would the thresholds be and what would the response options be if those thresholds were exceeded. And a big piece of why that took so long was the group feeling a need to have a balanced wildlife and livestock approach, and that it wasn't fair for one group to just take it on the chin and the other group got off free, and that it really needed to be a balanced approach. Also, lots of discussion about scale and timing is critical. If you do a 500-acre burn and you have a bunch of animals that are swarming that area, your chances of exceeding those thresholds is going to be higher than if you could pull off a 5,000-acre burn and followed up by another 5,000-acre burn and theoretically be able to overwhelm the animals. So scale and timing is really, really important. So some of the response options, you know, coordinating with the division, being able to hire folks to spend time in these treatment areas, hazing wildlife. Fencing is an option as a last resort, in my opinion, but it certainly is an option. You know, kind of like that livestock project where I talked about improving timing and intensity and the rotation schedules and the time of when the livestock are there could be looked at some more in other allotments. Fairly standard for the Forest Service to, after a treatment, to rest that from livestock use for 2 to 3 years. Potentially, you know, using some grass bank programs to help offset some of those impacts if we do get there. And then really that last bullet is the meat and potatoes of why I'm here today. One of those response options could be recommending to the division through you in the RAC and eventually to the Wildlife Board some antlerless hunts that could take place in a treatment area in a given specific area to keep pressure in those treatment areas and to allow those aspen enough time to be able to get to 6 feet height. At one point during the process of putting together these response options, there was a proposal on the table, for example, to do some preemptive hunts. And that just did not get support because the idea was, or the concern was, that if there's no guarantee when you'll be able to do that burn, you know, weather and moisture and funding, and there's no guarantee that, although we may have the greatest intentions to do a burn this fall, there's no guarantee that that would happen. And so is it right to go in and do a preemptive hunt this spring when maybe that treatment's going to happen this fall, maybe it's not. It could be 2 or 3 years. And so what the Juan Oro Mountain Working Group came to consensus on was potentially going through this process, getting the approval, so that after a burn occurred, if the monitoring tells us that we need to respond, then we'd have those permissions in place to be able to act in a more timely and efficient manner. We may do a burn, and the thresholds, we don't ever exceed them, and although that permission is there, we don't ever act upon it. And I'm sure there'll be some more questions about that one afterwards, but there was a lot and lot of discussion about that one, and acknowledging that, you know, Forest Service doesn't have that decision authority, and it case by case, it would have to go through the RAC process and the Wildlife Board process. And that any antlerless hunts would be viewed as temporary, not support for long-term reductions, and just enough to get those treatment areas in that aspen to 6 feet tall, to where they're above that breast height, where they're not susceptible to completely being eaten. So Monroe Mountain Working Group supports that thresholds document. They were the ones that submitted it to us and asked us to include it in the EIS, acknowledging, you know, the wildlife end of things is subject to this group and the Wildlife Board. You know, I talked about the balanced wildlife livestock approach. Scale and timing, we think, is very, very key. And so my big reason for being here is asking the RAC and eventually the Wildlife Board to support and voice your support through a letter that we could include in our EIS so that as we get questions, and we have gotten questions on this issue, that we can have that in our project that says, you know, we've gone through this process and people have reviewed this and the appropriate folks are supportive of what we're trying to do here. And with that, I'll take questions.
Any questions from the board? Lane.
I just have a question. Is the thinning that's going out there, going on there just to the west of Indian Peak, is that part of this program?
It's going on right now.
Is that a commercial program?
It is an Aspen project. It was through a separate NEPA process that occurred 4 or 5 years ago. And so there is a few projects that we're currently implementing in the neighborhood of 4,000 acres is the scale, Box Creek being one of them, up there by Indian Peak being another one. This EIS that we're looking at, instead of being 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 acres, we're talking more like 40,000 or 50,000 acres over the next decade.
But that project is an Aspen project.
Yes.
Yep.
Once these trees reach 6 feet or whatever it is you're proposing to get, what benefits from the aspen after they've grown that much and they get out of reach as far as feeding goes? Do they eat the leaves when they fall in the fall, or, you know, what benefit do wildlife or the cattle get from the aspens after they reach that point?
Yeah, and so aspen are continually growing, and so even though you get one flush that's to 6 feet tall, there's still going to be other aspen that are growing that are less than 6 feet tall. They do like to eat the leaves. Aspen is also an ecosystem that provides for great grasses and forbs and cover and hiding, and it's more than just the aspen leaves.
Have you considered or have you talked about what's going to happen October 1st or October 6th when the spike gun opens on the Dutton? And you have 300 or 400 elk crossing Kingston Canyon going to the Monroe, and there is no hunts on the Monroe because they voted down the spike hunt. Have you talked about that? Are you going to present this to the big game board?
I'm going to look to Kevin to help me with.
That's probably out of my Forest Service.
Let me just explain how I picture this process happening. First of all, we're probably 3 to 5 years down the road before anything gets proposed. Is that fair based on before projects hit the ground because of the process you guys have to go through?
Yeah, to get through the NEPA process, and then we know that we've got to do some mechanical ahead of the prescribed fire. It takes some prep time for those mechanical. So, yeah, 3 to 5 years.
So say we're 5 years from now, and they've gone through the NEPA process and everything's approved, and they have a proposal for a 6,000-acre burn on a portion of the Monroe. What the RAC might see in that case is a proposal for the division that says, if this burn takes place, and if the thresholds are crossed, we want the authority from the RAC and the ultimately from the board to implement, you know, X number of cow tags in this specific area. But if one, the burn never happens, or two, the thresholds are never crossed, we would never implement that. So it's a way to give us the protection, given the system we have, which has about a year to 18-month lag, to get that lag out of the system so that we can be responsive, as Jason says, but do it in a way. The two things that the division and the sportsman insisted on with this document is, A, you've got to do big projects. You've got to do projects that are at the scale of 5,000 acres, not 500 acres. And B, we're not going to do anything preemptive. Certainly, we support the idea of more aspen, but there's a burns are often planned and are planned a lot more often than they're implemented, and sometimes a particular burn it may be proposed and it's 5 years later before it's actually implemented. So we didn't see or would not support the idea of preemptively removing elk when nothing's going to happen, potentially something might happen for 5 years. So this was the system that was proposed. It gives everybody the flexibility, protects the resources that we have out there for sportsmen. It's a temporary thing. And I guess the bottom line is, in the end, the more aspen habitat that we can create on Monroe Mountain and anywhere in southern Utah or the West, benefits wildlife and it benefits livestock. It's just a more productive ecosystem, so it's worth taking a short-term hit for a long-term benefit is essentially what we're talking about. And that's kind of the concept that the forest is asking the RAC and eventually the Wildlife Board to endorse. But we've had to walk a little bit of a tightline here because the last thing the division wants to do is undermine the board's authority by attaching it to a federal process. And so we've been very careful in the way that letter was written so that it's very clear that the forest doesn't have the Forest Service doesn't have the authority to call for a cow hunt, and anything that happens will come back through the RAC and board process. But it's this process, or the concept of doing this that they're asking for you guys and the Wildlife Board to endorse. Is that?
Yep, right on.
Just a clarification. What we're asking for from the RAC committee tonight. It's just an endorsement.
Just an endorsement. Well, a recommendation to the Wildlife Board for an endorsement. Yeah.
So we're basically endorsing the Forest Service in this plan that they have in place.
Yeah.
And endorsing that thresholds document.
Endorsing the letter that was in your packet, essentially.
DeLoss, I know you're on the committee. If you want to make a clarification, that'd be fine.
DeLoss Christensen, Glenwood, Utah. Cordell, let me try and answer your specific question more specifically, if I could. One of the things that the work group had to do was be unanimous. Now, you saw that list. That's a lot of different people and different interests and personalities. And this thing had to be unanimously supported by everybody. We all wanted aspens treated, but then we all wanted to make sure that we didn't get hurt by doing so. And we think we did that. But here's what's going to happen now. When the Forest Service goes to NEPA, there's going to be people who don't want that aspen work done. And they're going to ask, why did you do this? Why didn't you do that? How come you're not doing this? And one of the questions from the sportsman's perspective is, how are you going to keep those elk unfenced out of those aspens? How are you going to make sure that those elk don't mow down that entire reseed effort? So we had to develop a way without giving the impression that the Forest Service could just go in and kill them. That was the challenge, is how can we satisfy those anti-hunters, those people who are going to oppose this plan and stop that aspen work from being done, how can we prepare this so that they can't come back and say the elk are going to destroy the work and destroy the aspens? So we couldn't give them just a blank check to say kill all our elk, and we wouldn't. So we had to say to them, it has to go through the racks and it has to go through the board. And can you give us some small percentage, if necessary, of elk to be taken at strategic times to make sure that the elk stay off that reseed before it's up high enough that they can't ruin it? So when those elk come over from the Dutton that you're talking about, if they are in fact destroying that aspen reseed, then Kevin, through the authority of the rack and the boards, can take some activity to make sure that they stop doing that and move to a different area on the mountain. Does that make sense?
Thank you, Delos. Do you have any further questions from the rack? Questions from the public?
I'm Tudor Ogden. I'm the county commissioner for Sevier County. I've sat on this board for about 3.5 years, and it's been quite a process to get to this point. We are certainly in favor of this project that Jason has presented this evening. As DeLoss come on board a little bit later, we've had a lot of heated debates over the wildlife. We've had a lot of debates over the livestock. Different things with the environmental groups. As you look down through that group, there's a lot of people there that's represented. One thing that I would hope that this is going to go through, because if it does, this could actually be a model for other rangelands that are having the same kind of issues. The Monroe, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Monroe Mountain. It's very unhealthy, and it's in bad shape. We've got a lot of work to do. The Forest Service has to play catch-up to make this happen because of all of the litigation that they have to go through. This is one of the best shots we have to improve the mountain range up there and to make it viable. I think the forest is kind of like a garden. It needs to be taken care of. And I think for the wildlife side of things, for the livestock side of things, and for the overall recreation of that Monroe Mountain, I think that we all need to be on board and support this effort. There was a question asked, what does an aspen look like if it's been browsed? Go up there and look. It's very bushy, and they don't get very tall. So, and they only have, you know, 2 or 3 years to make that effort, and then they finally just give up. And a lot of those areas have been overgrazed. A lot of them have been taken care of. A lot of it is because of the conifer overreach up there. We've got a lot of conifer. You've got a lot of subalpine fir that's really just a weed as far as I'm concerned on the mountain. So anyway, I would hope that you guys would support this effort, and going forward, it's been a long process. I keep asking, Jason, you know, how much longer are we going to be? You know, this has been 3.5 years, and I'm a little hopeful that this goes through and we don't have a lot of public comment and problems when we get to that point. We're going to be able to take some action and get some things done up there. So anyway, we hope that you consider supporting this effort going forward. We appreciate the RAC, what you guys do, your time spent to make things better for all of us, and also the DWR. I think there's a lot of efforts to go into that. We've had some good support from the DWR on this project as well. So anyway, that's what my pitch is, and hope we can have your support on this. Thank you.
Any questions for me?
I think Jason probably answered them all.
We did have a comment card from Tudor. We want to make sure we have the audience covered. Do we have any other questions from the audience? Okay, we'll turn it over to the RAC.
Any other comments as well?
We'll turn it over to the RAC for comments. If not, we're ready to entertain a motion.
Sounds like a really good plan. Hope it works. I make a motion that we accept the Aspen Restoration Plan as presented.
Okay, we have first a motion to accept the plan and a second. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor? Looks like it's unanimous. As far as any other business goes, please note that the next meeting is going to be in Richfield, and it'll be at the Snow College Sevier Valley Center at 7 p.m. So that's September 9th, and we'll be discussing the fishing recommendations. It's been a long night.
Same location.
Okay.
Before you beat that gavel, let me just remind everybody that if you want a hard copy to bring like we normally have, you better let Stacy know or you're not going to get one.
Okay, thanks for your comments. Call this meeting adjourned.